You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
Stephen Doyle here. Great start here, filling in for the lads who I can assure you have all not been taken away to have their hearts resuscitated after the football action last night. Of course, Tottenham Hotspur versus Manchester City, the match on everybody's lips this morning. I'm joined in studio this morning by a world boxing champion, Andy Lee, and our own news sports editor, John Duggan, super Spurs fan as well. Good morning, lads. Welcome
Andy,
to the show.
How are we all doing? Not
well,
as good as you, I don't
probably,
think.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what, you know, the sedatives. I didn't take any sedatives, but I kind of feel like I have. I don't know what it's like, but I'm just completely dazed and confused right now.
There was an incredible moment last night, John, when the goal was scored by Raheem Sterling, the goal we thought that was after winning the tie for Manchester City. And I know, look, everybody thinks the whole VAR thing. I'm on the fence with VAR. I'm not too sure whether I like it or whether I don't. It does give us that opportunity to make sure that decisions are ruled on correctly. But it does, of course, take away the human elements of it all. But I really thought it added to the drama last night, because when that goal was scored, we saw Raheem Sterling going off with that brilliant celebration. Pep Guardiola was celebrating. Pochettino, he just looked destroyed. I saw Dele Alli sitting on the ground. He just looked like he wanted to be swallowed up. And then all of a sudden, the emotions are changed because the VAR makes the decision and all of a sudden the roles are reversed. And I just thought it was one of the most incredible moments of drama we've ever seen in the sporting field.
Yeah, and a football field, and such a new thing, Stephen, isn't it? And it's interesting to get your take as a neutral, because my take was that I'd been through a roller coaster of emotions, pretty internalised, to be honest, because I always felt that City can up a gear. They did that when Spurs went 2-1 up, like Spurs as you can get to concede within a minute. Then Sterling made a 3-2, then Aguero scores. You're kind of thinking, look, this is done for. But I always felt Spurs could score a goal. I thought City were poor defensively. I always thought we might have a bit of a chance. Llorente bundles the ball home. We get a VAR decision our way. I think it did come off his hip. I think it was a goal. But there were the drama, and as a supporter, the feelings I had, I couldn't believe Eriksen didn't get rid of the ball. And then it's played back in from Bernardo Silva to Aguero. He squares it to Sterling. It goes in. And you're absolute, complete, utter devastation. Devastation that I felt that this has happened once again as a Tottenham Hotspur fan. And when they had that Hollywood Truman Show pausing the tape almost of life, reversing it, and then deciding, you know what, we're going to look at this again, I was so devastated that even when they reversed it, I didn't celebrate. I couldn't react because I was so stunned. Yeah. And I'm still stunned. Like, it's less than, I don't know how many hours, is it 12 hours later or whatever. I won't be able to celebrate this until tomorrow. I won't be able to actually allow this to sink in and think about the semi-final, because as a football fan, you've always lived in the instant and in the moment, as you're saying. I was living in the instant and the moment of Tottenham blowing it again, and then to be told, you know what, for once ever as a Tottenham fan or as a club, you haven't blown it, you're going through, you get the Willy Wonka ticket, you're going through to the semi-final. And to see Pep Guardiola, as you say, go bananas, and then like, what if it's like for you as a neutral, or for, you know, myself as a fan? Imagine what it's like for the players, for the management, for the staff, for everybody involved in the clubs, for the supporters who were there. It was box office drama, whatever the quality of the game, box office drama.
So, just in terms of the feeling after, did you feel a little bit like it was taken away from you?
I just felt so stunned and like I'd been hit over the head with something. I was walking around in a complete confusion.
And what about the offside? Like, it was
offside.
Yeah.
It
was marginal. But
it was very tight. Just the fact that the play played on, it wasn't flagged up at the time, and they played out.
And that was the interesting thing, wasn't it, Andy? Because, you know,
he was halfway down the pitch, Sterling, celebrating.
The Spurs fans weren't even arguing the goal. You know, they thought it was a legitimate goal, which I thought was the interesting thing. Folks, if you're a Spurs fan and the result has sunk in, you can tweet us at Off the Ball. Let us know what your thoughts are. Andy, well, I knew you were coming on the show this morning, and I was trying to think of a kind of a similar boxing event that I saw to that match, because I thought, you know, it was the most dramatic game of football I've ever seen in the Champions League. And somebody said to me, you know, recency bias, when I made the comment on Twitter, and they mentioned the Barcelona PSG game, which is fair enough, but Barcelona just hammered PSG out the gate. It was 6-1. But I was thinking of Bernard Dunn versus Ricardo Cordoba. You had these two great teams, like the two great fighters in the ring. the fight just kept swinging from fighter to fighter. They both went down three times during that fight. And it was like that game last night. You know, nobody, there wasn't a stage where any team really kind of went, you know, had a 2-3 goal lead. It was swinging from team to team. Did you kind of feel it would be something similar like that?
Yeah, well, it's a good comparison because at one stage it looked like Brandon was done, you know, and then he comes back and finishes at the end and it looked like Spurs were done, but they didn't finish. But they got the good decision, which was the right decision, you know, looking back. But it was an incredible game.
I think as well, John, and I said to you earlier on in studio or in the office that if you're in the Champions League at a stage like this and you're a team like Manchester City with all the talent that they have, and if you go and play the away leg first and cannot score against your opposition team and then bring them back to your place and concede three goals, you don't deserve to go through.
No, you don't. And that's not just me saying that as a Tottenham fan, Stephen. It's I don't understand what's got into Pep Guardiola's head about the Champions League. There's something in his head. It's rattling around his head, almost like he's got the yips about it. Was De Bruyne injured for that first game? Because if he wasn't injured, it was a criminal offence.
The chemical ban said last night on commentary that he's playing the best football of his life.
But De Bruyne is one of the best players in the world.
And why didn't he play last week?
What's caution? What's that all about? Mm. Spurs worked really hard last week and they got their just desserts and they got a goal. Spurs are just walking wounded now. Son is suspended for the first leg against Ajax. Sissoko went off injured. I was looking at the bench last night. They've got nobody. Mm. They've nobody left. And City, what happens if they just play that way in the first leg with a bit of conviction, as they've shown in the league, and go and just beat Spurs?
Son's an interesting one, John. He seems to play better
with Harry Kane out of the team.
There.
Yeah, like I'm so disappointed that he won't be there for the first leg. It's a funny one now. I mean, I still think it will be alive for the second leg. So he's playing such good football. The second goal was beautiful, but even his defensive work later on in the game was good, and he didn't sulk when he got the yellow card. And interesting what you said about VAR, that, you know, if City had got away with that and it had been shown then later on that Spurs were, you know, had been robbed, what would the kind of the narrative be? So look, VAR has changed the way you almost view the game through a lens as a fan, and in the most dramatic moment possibly in the history of being a Spurs fan, it's just left you completely on the floor. But as a concept, I do think it is right. But it is now brought a degree of pause to a game that was so free-flowing and that would have maybe, I think they said 95% of refereeing decisions correct. Now it's 99% with the system.
We've got a poll up on at Off the Ball. You can only have one in your team. Son from Spurs or Raheem Sterling. So if you want to get on to Off the Ball AM, at Off the Ball AM, Son or Sterling. And we actually have a result there. 45% Son Heung-min, 55% Raheem Sterling. Good 1,147 votes there, John. I don't think that one can be disputed. Raheem Sterling, he's having an amazing season.
Yeah. I feel sorry for him this morning. It was a brilliant opening goal. He's just an excellent player, and I think Trippier and Rose really struggled last night. Spurs are too narrow defensively. I think
especially on the first goal.
Yeah, I think we can separate a quality game. We'll probably discuss this on offtheball.com later in the day, but a quality game. To be fair, there were five goals, I think, in the first 21 minutes from a great game. So Italy-Brazil in 82 is a great game. Was this a great game? It had great moments, but it had also had pretty, five-a-side element to it. I think, as you were saying on Twitter, Stephen, and kind of a keystone stop, cops defending.
Yeah.
But look, it's done now. The quadruple's over. City will probably murder Spurs on Saturday. They'll probably win the league, but Liverpool are also in a position where they could do the double. So football, as you say, bloody hell. I'm going to probably put my head under a tap or under a duvet and celebrate tomorrow.
Well, enjoy the celebrations, John, and we will be talking to you again, I'm sure, about the Ajax game when that's coming up. But coming up on Off the Ball, we'll have that very shortly for you. First of all, I want to mention our Cricket Ireland competition. We've got a brilliant competition for you all this week on Off the Ball AM. It's all with thanks to Turkish Airlines, proud sponsors of Cricket Ireland. Here at OTB AM, we're giving you the chance to fly anywhere in the world with Turkish Airlines. To enter, just head to the link we've tweeted and posted in our live stream for OTB AM and fill in the entry form. Ireland is facing the busiest summer of cricket we've ever known, hosting some of the biggest teams in the world, such as England, West Indies and Bangladesh. On May 3rd, the Ireland men's team will face England in Malahide. I've been out there for a game against England. It is absolutely brilliant. The atmosphere, the weather, hopefully will be good for it. So with that Tri series against Bangladesh and the West Indies to follow. So do go along to the find that link there on the OTB AM Twitter feed. So coming up next, or over the morning on Off the Ball AM, we'll have the sports pages for you coming up now with myself and Andy Lee. At 10 past 8 then, we'll talk Champions League with the Spanish football journalist Graham Hunter. Then at 8:30, we'll have former Ireland international Gordon Darcy, and he'll be on to chat about the new Aviva Stadium tours, as well as Leinster and Munster's chances in this week's Heineken Champions Cup semi-finals. Then myself and Andy Lee are going to talk about one of our passions in life outside of sport, music. Looking forward to that one, Andy. And then coming up then after that, then we'll be speaking to the boxer Ryan Burnett. Andy will be having a good chat with him this hour or this morning. And then we're going to have an exclusive reveal for you at 9 o'clock this morning. I can't give you any more details. Tommy, our producer, has forbidden me, as much as I'd like to tell you. Then we'll have Phil Egan in for the sports news at 9:05. And then that's followed up with Owen Sheehan's chat with Chet Gladchuk. That's all coming up on Off the Ball AM this morning. So let's have a quick look at the newspapers before we go any further. So starting off then with the Irish Daily Star. And if you see here, I like a lot of this morning's papers are going with the VAR puns. So I like this one, Hand of Quad. Of course, a reference there, Andy, to the quadruple that Manchester City were going for last night. And of course, that was ended by that man, Fernando Llorente's goal, which came off his hip, although some would say it came off his elbow, just a tickle off his elbow before it came off his hip. Oh My Quad, another one there on the Irish Daily, or sorry, that's the Daily Star, the English Daily Star. VAR kills off City's bid for four titles as Spurs triumph. Just looking then at the Irish Examiner Sport. Breathtaking. City's quadruple dream over as Spurs edge all-time classic. Liverpool set up Barca clash. The Liverpool game has kind of gone unnoticed with all the drama from last night. I don't know if you saw any of the goals from the Liverpool game, Andy, but it just seemed to go under the radar, really, didn't it?
It was a done deal before it even kicked off, wasn't
it? Yeah, absolutely.
Manny scored, so it was, it was done,
Certainly was. The Irish Mirror Sports. Actually, the more I look at these papers now, they are a lot of them using the quad pun. Oh My Quad, 7 goals and 2 incredible VAR controversies as Sterling's last gasp winners is ruled out to shatter Pep dream. I don't know about you, Andy, but I am glad to see the back of Pep Guardiola's Cardi coat now that they've gone out of the Champions League. It's one of the most awful pieces of clothing I've ever seen.
A lot of fratties. We're getting slated for it.
I know you're a man who likes your dapper clothing. Yeah. I don't think you'd be seen wearing one of those anyway.
I don't know if it was a cold night in Manchester and I had nothing else. I'd be putting it on.
Absolutely. We'll move on then to the Irish Indo, Irish Independent. The back page there. City win the battle but lose the VAR. Nice one there. There's also an interesting story there on the back of the Indo. The GAA declares ban on foreign training camps from next year. Martin Breteny writing that story. And he's just talking about, he makes reference to the Armagh and Laois footballers both losing home advantage for one game in this season's Allianz League as punishment for breaking the rules on training camps last year. Armagh travelled to Portugal while Laois went to Kerry, both deemed to have broken the rule because camps were held outside the permitted time. He mentions Dublin, the Dublin footballers, Wexford Hurlers, of course, who went to France and Portugal respectively. They both escaped sanction after insisting their trips did not include training. But he's saying that Congress amended the relevant rule this year, make it mandatory for counties to receive permission from the CCCC to undertake extended training camps either at home or abroad. They then decided that permission would be granted in cases where counties gave a guarantee to have 4 weekends free for club activity between the end of the league and the opening championship game. However, in a more sweeping move, permission will not be granted for overseas trips from 2020 on. There will also be a limit on home-based camps, which cannot be longer than 3 days. So, an interesting story there. Mm. So you have the Herald there in front of you.
Have the Herald, on the front page, just a bridge to VAR. It's all VAR puns across the board, and they're all hitting the same kind of note. But some great photos of Llorente celebrating. And what about Llorente Son, if Kane is fit for the final, does he get a start? What's your feelings on that?
Like, Llorente, he's a strange fish because, you know, he had a really good career before Spurs and he's never really kicked on. He's a squad player, you know. I think I can see, if Son's suspended, I think they'll go with Lucas Moura as leading the attack. He got a hat-trick there against Huddersfield just over a week ago. Yeah. He's a decent option there. There was a couple of players I was actually disappointed with last night. Dele Alli, I thought, was a little bit quiet. I thought Christian Eriksen, who's, as Irish fans know, we've been on the receiving end of Christian Eriksen for Denmark. I thought he was pretty poor last night as well. I just thought some of those players maybe just didn't stand up to the fight when they were called upon.
Yeah, when you look at the defence like Laporte, and there was like what John was saying, great games of quality versus exciting games that are entertainment for the fans. Like, I think last night was definitely, there was some great quality in it, but it was more on the exciting side of kind of entertainment and the mistakes and the end-to-end where both teams just were going at it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was more of that, wasn't it?
Where does the Champions League sit for you as a sporting occasion? Are you...
When your team's in it and they're in the latter stages, it's the best thing in the world, isn't it? I'm a Man United fan, so
yeah.
We had a tough week there, you know, the rough night on Tuesday, but no, it's great. Like, there are obviously great memories watching it. I remember watching the final in 99.
Yeah,
and being alone watching it.
Where were you?
I was in Finglas, living in Finglas at the time.
That's where my granny's from.
None of my family are big football fans, and especially not my United fans.
Yeah.
And I was just on my own. I was screaming and beaming. Like, I can't remember what I was, 15, 14 at the time, but it was...
Yeah.
So I still remember it, yeah.
And obviously Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was a big character that night. Do you think he's still the man for the job?
It's hard to know, isn't it? Well, I think he's the man for the job. They're with him now, so you got to stick with him and back him. I think at least give him one transfer, you know, the summer, to see what he can do. It's interesting just the attitudes of the players and the change. I don't know. I think when he came in, I think some of them performed well, trying to prove a point against Mourinho, and now that it's kind of settled down, they've kind of reverted back to type and kind of plateaued a little bit. That was a huge mistake by Ashley Young, wasn't it? You know, and once that goes in, and then David De Gea, one going underneath his body, the second goal, then that's kind of right. No matter how well you perform, you make those individual mistakes, it ruins the whole team. The whole plan goes out the window. So
To be fair to Solskjaer as well, I think he's got a squad there that just isn't good enough for that level of football against a team like Barcelona. I think they need to both get rid of a lot of players and bring in a lot of new players this summer. Like this,
need established players. They don't need young starlets that are going to develop into players. They need proven players.
Yeah,
you know, they have enough young mix there now. Even Lingard and Rashford, they're still young. McTominay,
yeah,
but they need to go out and get a Van Dijk like Liverpool did and have an established star who can kind of take control of things.
So look, I think you have one more head there, Andy, before we...
There's still a few papers. They're all the same. It's dominated by Spurs and City, and the headline is madness. Llorente settled 7-goal further on night of pure madness. A little bit of a headline about Delaney's credit card spending under scrutiny. This is, I think, the investigated by Mazars, saying that he spent $40,000 in a six-month period in 2016, so... That's going to rumble on, isn't it, and go on and on and on.
Absolutely.
It doesn't get any better looking for John Delaney, does it? <doesn't>, you know? it's like, with these things, like the administrator, like, when it works well in any administration, anybody, you don't hear about it, you don't even take notice of it, you don't even come into your consciousness.
Well, I can think of one like Gary Keegan with the boxing side, for instance.
Yeah. And I know Kieran Cunningham has been in here giving his endorsement for Gary, and I would be the same. I think he would be an ideal candidate. He's not a football man, but in terms of sport and administration, his attitude and his professionalism, and you couldn't meet a more honest man in terms of, like, you know, spending or whatever it may be. You know, he's as straight as they come. So, that's just the way it is. Yeah.
I want to get your thoughts on a story in the Irish Independent, Andy, just on the inside lines. It says, Taylor fears allayed after Joshua's fighting pledge. Fears that Katie Taylor's unification fight with Belgium's Delphine Persoon was to be postponed after American heavyweight Jarrell Big Baby Miller failed a drugs test were allayed last night. This, of course, referring to Katie Taylor, we only heard this week that she was after getting the big fight that she wants against Delphine Pursoon, of course, to unite all of the women's lightweight belts. And no sooner than she had that fight been announced and she was put on the undercard to the massive heavyweight clash between Joshua and Miller, we find out that Miller's been popped for a positive drugs test. Now, it's alleged at the moment he has to go through, or they're going to test a second sample. He's, you know, saying that that the second sample will prove his innocence. The drug that he's taking, or he's alleged to have taken, is a fat-burning drug, which also can improve your stamina and that kind of thing. But look, I suppose I want to focus on the Taylor part of it more so. She might have been a little bit concerned, really, when she heard that news, I'm sure, this week.
Yeah, it was. It broke yesterday morning. I was actually in a texting conversation with her manager, Ryan Peters. I just seen that Big Baby's tested positive, and the conversation ended there. And then 3 or 4 hours later, he texts back, "Oh, it's all good." He said, "Yeah, it's all good." So apparently, Eddie Hearn said the first person he called when he was informed that that Miller had tested positive was Anthony Joshua, and he said he wants to fight. And it's been a while since he's fought, so he needs to stay busy. He hasn't fought this year yet, and you're looking at June. This fight will be in June, and then if he doesn't fight then, it'll be pushed back to maybe September. So he has to fight, and the fight's going ahead. They're looking at possible opponents for him. Every heavyweight who's in and around a contender kind of stage is putting their hand up and saying they want the fight. They want a big payday. But we'll see which way that plays out. But for Katie, her fight goes ahead. She's fighting Delphine Pursoon, probably her toughest opponent so far. Definitely the most decorated, undefeated, and for a long time, WBC champion. And for Katie, she winning this fight will mean that she has all the belts, that she's the unified champion, undisputed unified champion. So it's a huge fight for her.
Madison Square Gardens as well.
Yeah, she's going to be the co-feature. Which will be a huge statement for her, for women's boxing, to be pay-per-view in, like, at the co-main event at Madison Square Garden next to Anthony Joshua will be... It's great for her. Great standing, great platform for her. And Pursoon's a tough fighter. She's, like, in terms of her skill, she's not on Katie's level, but she's tough and she's strong. And she's almost... She's you can compare her to her style as, like, a Carl Froch type of a style, female version of that, where she'll come forward aggression with a lot of straight punches. So Katie will have to be defensive and elusive and pick her spots, I think.
She showed last time out, though, that she has got that stamina to, like, her opponents just slipped my mind, Andy, can you remember the...
Valente,
sorry.
Yeah.
Like, she it looked like the first round when she came out that she was going to end that fight within 2 or 3 rounds. Yeah. You know, Valente did really well to stand up to her, and I thought she, all credit to her as well, she fought brilliantly. But I just thought the way Katie managed that fight was really impressive.
Katie's always had this kind of, when she gets hit or when she hurts her opponents, she kind of sees red and has this kind of, you know, this kind of just wanting to fight, this eagerness to fight and trade. Sometimes that plays against her. Like, she hurt Valente and then she kind of traded and kind of played into Valente's hands a little bit. Immediately after that knockdown, because Katie was eager to get the stoppage and have the impressive stoppage win, but then she kind of fell out of a game plan, and that can happen. And with Pursoon, she has to be very disciplined, I guess, and not allow that to happen, because she'll get dragged into a fight and then she'll be playing into Delphine Pursoon's hands, you know. So I think just box a smart, disciplined fight, use her skills, and she should win. I think she's something like 12-1 on favourite in the fight, so that'll tell you enough about it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, before we excuse me, bring the papers to an end, I just want to point you to a story as well in the Irish Sun this morning. It's by own football journalist Owen Couser. The headline there, "My daughter is like Dad, why do we always move? How do I answer that to a 4.5-year-old? So it's basically Richie Ryan, the former Sligo Rovers and Shamrock Rovers footballer. And just an interesting little story, because he has signed for a new club in El Paso Locomotive. El Paso on the west coast of the United States. He's basically had a career on the East Coast, most recently with Cincinnati. Ryan is 34 and had been expected to move into coaching And he's just talking about just the difficulty he's had because he thought he was going to stay with Cincinnati coaching, had to move then to El Paso. And he's just talking about the disruption for his family. He explains here, for me as a player, it doesn't really bother me that I've moved again, but I have a young family. We're settled in really well in Cincinnati. We're moving my daughter to a new school now. She's 4 and a half. She had friends in school, sleepovers and play dates. And you say that, Holly, we're on the move again. She's like, Dad, why do we always move? How do I answer that to a 4 and a half year old? But look, he's got a new club, he's got a new contract. Good to see Richie making money, but it can be a lonely life as a sportsman in America, as you know too well.
Yeah, and your family have to, like, everyone has to go along with you on the journey. You know, it's a selfish endeavor a lot of the time. You have to be, but he has to, like, for him, he has to provide, I guess. And two cities I know well and completely different in terms of the culture. Cincinnati. It, you know, it's kind of in the Midwest, and it's predominantly black, and there's kind of a, not a hip hop, but, you know, that kind of element to the city. Some great fighters from there, from Cincinnati, real, like, stronghold of amateur boxing.
Yeah.
In that area. And then El Paso, that's where I fought Chavez Jr. And then you're talking about basically Mexico. This side of the street is Texas, El Paso, and that side of the street is Mexico. No, so. And that's a tough place. Like, yeah. A lot of cartels down there. It's dangerous. The week I went there before the Chavez fight, there was severed heads put on spikes on the freeway flyover. Because there was some flare up, and even the fight with Chavez was kind of there was a chance it could get cancelled because of all this cartel kind of activity. So. I'll tell you, man.
I thought the National Stadium was there.
You keep yourself to yourself, I'd say. You're right, you know.
Great stuff, Andy. Well, look, all this morning on OTB AM, we're giving you the chance to win an amazing trip to Japan for the Rugby World Cup. We're asking you three questions across the morning, and they're all related to the same game. Ireland's Rugby World Cup quarterfinal defeat to Argentina in 2015. Always the bad memories when it comes to the World Cup, isn't it? So we're asking you those three questions. To be in with a chance of winning, you've got to answer all three questions in the same tweet or comment. We tweeted question one at 7:45 a.m. And that question was, how many points did Ireland lose to Argentina by in that Rugby World Cup quarterfinal? So get on to Off the Ball AM or at Off the Ball. Say, stay tuned. And take note of your answers, and you can send us all three after 9 a.m. in the same message. We're going to pick a winner for 9:30. We're going to do question two for you as well. So question two there, who scored Ireland's first try in that Rugby World Cup quarterfinal defeat to Argentina? Who scored Ireland's first try in that Rugby World Cup quarterfinal defeat to Argentina? So keep note of all those answers, and then you can send us all three after 9 a.m. and we will pick a winner then. So we're going to talk football with Graeme Hunter next on OTB AM. So here's first Dermot Corrigan, the football journalist, on David De Gea.
Just wanted to ask about De Gea. You know, I don't know how much Premier League football is watched over there, but if you're a Real Madrid fan and you maybe watch the odd occasional big Barcelona game as well, and maybe you watch the World Cup where De Gea has a bit of a nightmare, he's still unbelievably highly regarded, I presume, in spite of bizarre mistakes like last night and some dodgy showings for Spain.
I think the World Cup really, really damaged him. Excuse me. That he was just so bad at the World Cup. And he doesn't seem to have come back from that. Even a couple of the games for Spain, a couple of the game against England in the Nations League and the games that Spain have played since then, he hasn't looked that confident. He doesn't come off his line, you know, and Spain need a keeper who will come off his line and will sweep up behind them, dominate the area, come for crosses and stuff. And nobody doubts that he is a really good shot stopper and maybe the best shot stopper around. Spain don't have a really serious number two to put pressure onto him, but it's definitely gone quiet. The idea that Madrid would break the bank to try to sign him, or that he'd be a big priority for Madrid, for Real Madrid this summer, looks very unlikely. They have Keylor Navas and Courtois there at the minute, and maybe one of them will leave. But De Gea's, his stock has fallen a lot, and last night just couldn't.
Off the Ball is Joe Malloy there speaking to Spanish football journalist Dermot Corrigan about David De Gea. It's been a tough 12 months for David De Gea. He had a blunder in the World Cup as well, Andy. I feel sorry for goalkeepers, though, because it's an unforgiving position, isn't it? Because
it
if
is,
you make a mistake, everybody knows about it. You don't have anybody there to cover you.
He's probably suffering from his own kind of excellence, you know, in terms of that when those, even like blunt end chance, like chances that you're sure that a striker's going to score, he'd come up with a save. You know, in times when he was never supposed to save it, he would save it. And now he's not. Not a lot of the times. He's still making unbelievable saves, but there are one or two that are slipping under him, like Tuesday night and other ones. And even down to his distribution is not as, doesn't seem to be as good as it used to be, or his decision making with his passing out. And I don't know. You don't know. He's been there a long time now, and I think he's had a desire to leave United. And with his performances now, it's kind of making it more of a possibility, I would say, that they could see letting him go because of how he's been playing.
Yeah, because he hasn't signed that contract, which United would like them to sign. I know Real Madrid were definitely sniffing around him for a while. It's interesting, the goalkeeper thing. It's almost like they're an individual sportsman within that team. You know, we know that sometimes the individual sports can be the toughest, like boxing, golf, snooker, because you're out there on your own, and you could probably draw comparisons between goalkeepers and those kind of individual sports people as well.
Yeah, but they have to play within the team, you know, and you can say, what's in front of the head of the season? You know, it's been chopping and changing a little bit. No, Lingard, Lindelof, and then Baid and Jones and Smalling, and there's never been any consistency. And recently, Rojo, you know, there's been never been any consistency. So it's hard to organise a defence like that and even have trust, I guess. You know, I don't know. That definitely would create doubt in your mind if you can't trust, if you don't feel that trust is in front of you with the players. Like any individual sport, it's all internal. It's all it's mental, but you have to this kind of internal dialogue with yourself constantly, and building yourself up and playing things out. You know, so it's tough. Like you said, it's just probably the toughest position to play in.
Yeah, because it's even like last year we remember Loris Karius and for Liverpool, obviously had that big blunder in the Champions League final, a couple of big blunders, and you know, you'd wonder when these things happen, like, have they got to sit down with maybe a sports psychologist or something like that? Karius just hasn't come back really from that.
Yeah, but even looking
at last year,
Lloris recently had a couple of blunders, but he was backed immediately by Pochettino, and I think something like that. And I don't think De Gea is, there's no one there to challenge him anyway, in terms of for his position. He's not under pressure. I don't think he's been the one goal on Tuesday night, you could probably fault him for that. He probably should have saved. But when you look at what's in front of him, Messi allowed to waltz through like that and with no one getting near him, it's hard to blame him, you know, put the finger on him. But he's had it, for a few years there, he was untouchable. He was definitely the best goalkeeper in the world, and he would make saves when he was never meant to make a save. But that's just slightly starting to slip now, and I'm sure for him there will be a little bit of doubt. That's where the test of character will come, and see what he's made of. Because it's easy when you're on top and when everything's going well, and having good performances will embolden that kind of confidence in yourself. But when you're not performing well and the doubts start to creep in, that's when you see what you're made of.
We are trying to get Spanish football journalist Graeme Hunter on the line. We should have him hopefully in the next few moments, just to discuss the whole Pep v Poch dynamic, and also about Barcelona and maybe their chances going forward in the competition. We know Graeme is he's an expert on all things Spanish football. Do you, Andy, take great joy watching Lionel Messi playing football still?
I do, yeah. And let's talk of this Barcelona team not being the great side. I think they're a little bit underrated. They are class, and when you see how they play it, they can just play it out. The one player was in the corner. He was in the corner of his own half, and just under pressure by two or three players, and just casually plays it out from the back. And they're just a well-oiled machine, aren't they? Because everyone knows their role within their team and where to make the runs to offer space. And Messi is the heartbeat of that, isn't he? You know. We're very fortunate to be watching him play live and week in and week out, and it'll be a long time before someone fills that void of greatness when he's gone.
Where do you stand on the Messi v Ronaldo debate?
Oh, as a United fan, I was always, you know, probably blindly backing United. They're completely different players, aren't they? Mm. You know, the thing is, Messi kind of makes... they both improve a team, but Ronaldo's more of an individual within a team, isn't he, as well, when we spoke about the keepers like that. He's an individual, and I guess he demands more from his teammates, or it's kind of self-driven that the rest of the team are just there to serve him. It seems that way to me. Messi's a team player, but there's also his brilliant shines. Messi's probably the better all-round footballer, but in terms of a goal-scoring machine or just a self-driven kind of guy, a winner, you could say Ronaldo. Like, they're hard to split, though, isn't it? It depends on what you like, you know?
I only saw Messi playing once live, and it was when he was over here for Argentina against the Republic of Ireland, and he was awful. I was like, I couldn't believe it was the first time I get to see him playing live, and he was really bad. I remember, as journalists, we all went out to see Argentina training out in Carlton House in a couple of days before the game was on, and so we all kind of got out to the training pitch. We're like, oh my God, we're going to see Messi here training, and this is going to be amazing. And it was funny because one of the Argentina players played a long ball to him. He was over the other end of the pitch, played a long ball to him, and Messi went to kind of control it with the ball under his foot, kind of miscontrolled it, slipped and fell over the ball. I was like, this is unbelievable.
That gives us all hope, doesn't it? Yeah. We're playing on Monday night five-a-side, and you know, it's not going well. If it can happen to Messi.
Definitely. Look, I think, like Ronaldo, I even said the other night, because we were talking about the Ajax-Juve game beforehand, and I just felt that you cannot back against Juventus with Ronaldo in that team. But it was interesting watching him coming off that pitch, because he just looked like, you know, he knew that he'd been brought... There was a lot of pressure on him coming into that Juventus team. They spent a lot of money to bring him in there, and he kind of failed, you know, that he couldn't get that goal or two to get him through into the next round.
Yeah, like in the previous round, though, he did have a big comeback, didn't he? You know, and kind of carried them through then. But there's only so much, and his age, you know, the age is coming on now, and like they're kind of mercenaries in a little way, aren't they? Like, you know, you look at the players they have; they don't seem like a succinct team. Juventus, a lot of big names, but they've played all over and never really settled anywhere. You know, and it seems like that any of them could move on at any time. It wouldn't really feel too probably don't feel any like ownership or belongingness to the club.
Well, Andy, I'm glad to say we won't have to speak about your five-a-side career. we're nearly getting that far. I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line by Spanish football journalist Graham Hunter. Good morning, Graham. How are you keeping, Graham?
Are we could champions football like that? Is that a serious question?
Well, it's great to talk to a fellow Paul Weller nut. I'm delighted to get you on the line here this morning.
But, let's stay on the mud, father. Let's get
Well, listen, I want to talk to you about a man who might be called the godfather of Spanish football in many years to come, Pep Guardiola. Graham, he's three attempts now at getting Manchester City into a semi-final, and he's failed. What's going on?
Big question. First and foremost, the beauty of football is that irrespective of what competition we're talking about, irrespective of VAR, this competition has always held a horseshoe in its punching glove. If it's not your night, you can lose in the most outrageous of ways. And that, I guess, would include the fact that as devastatingly cool as Liverpool's performance in the first leg last season was, City had a goal robbed from them last year that should have stood. It wasn't VAR. There is this season, and VAR has kind of turned a Nelson eye to Llorente's goal, where it definitely, however you want to interpret the laws, it bumps off his hand before his hip. There's no question about that at all. VAR didn't pick it up. VAR did absolutely correctly pick up Aguero. So we just paint that picture, even if you've said it 1,000 times this morning. Because whether it's VAR, whether it's a sleepy linesman, whether it's somebody, a genius, having a brilliant performance against you, whether it's one of your own players inexplicably tying his laces together, you know, at my age, and I'm old, You see the most ridiculous things in European football, in my view, more often than in elite domestic football. Partly because it's a knockout competition, partly because the club in front of you is one that you know less about. So going back to the last three editions of Pep Guardiola's work, I would say that last night is the oddest, the most extreme, and the one where you can bluntly say, as a dead-faced, Easter Island-faced Vinnie Kompany did last night, well, if we'd scored the penalty in the first leg, and he was right. But is that enough of what you're asking for? Is that, I mean, I don't know how many off the ball fans are City stalwarts and have been for decades, but if anybody is saying, well, Pep isn't as big as his reputation, why didn't the manager win it? I have always believed that unless you can actively pinpoint an outright outrageous decision not to start somebody, a poor substitution, outrageously bad tactics, it's obviously the players. It's obviously the players. I'd also say that from the beginning of this season, when I've been asked to tip, and please, those of you at home, don't put money on my actual tips. But when I've been asked to tip, I've said consistently, I don't think that City, particularly in how aggressively they defend without the ball, are hardcore enough yet to win the Champions League. Throughout this season, Pep has emphasised, and brothers, it isn't the fans that they lost this via, but he's saying this isn't yet a club, this isn't a fan base, this isn't yet a half of the city where you're demanded every day to win the Champions League. And he's been saying that's necessary, and I agree with him. I think that's a message that in years to come, City fans will say, we changed our attitude. Guardiola said you have to be obsessed with winning the Champions League. We are now, and that will be to their benefit. Last night, if you go back to last night, how would you explain it? Outrageously bad defending by City, which was only topped by the outrageously bad defending by Trippier. I you know, it was, if you only want entertainment, if you only want a Hearns Hagler slugfest, it was beautiful. Yeah. You want to sit down with a computer or a chalkboard and point out how many times you can do football badly. It was also quite a good example at the City Ground last night.
And I know last night's game was absolutely bonkers. Should we not be looking, though, at the first leg? Was he too conservative with his approach? And should he have played Kevin De Bruyne?
Yeah. Unless, I mean, it's all right for us on the outside to say, play De Bruyne, just leave it at that. De Bruyne is somebody who has struggled physically, who has needed to be in the right shape to impose himself, and City still have a title to win. And I'm not saying this only retrospectively. It's been clear all season that for players and staff, winning the title is the priority, and they still may. Was that in his mind? I don't know. Kevin De Bruyne looked retrospectively, given how he's played since last week in London, that he should have played more. Maybe he should have started. But rather than that, if you're looking at, again, I don't want to be defensive of Pep. In fact, I'm not being defensive of Pep. But if you look at that side that they played last week at Tottenham's new stadium, conservative. If you take, what was the front? Let's say there was David Silva, there was Sterling, there was Mahrez, there was Aguero. The only thing that he's now been called conservative for was that he paired, Fernandinho and Gundogan in the centre of defence. There was a time during your career and mine that a man playing a formation like that, 4-3-3, with players like that, or call it 4-2-3-1 if you wish, with players like that in an away Champions League quarter-final would have been called suicidally attacking. OK, we've got used to Pep not playing two organising midfielders. I take your point. But did he lose it because of the formation? Or from the first leg? Because of the missed penalty. Were there other chances when City could have put Spurs away, particularly once Kane was off? And you knew exactly that if you policed Son brilliantly, pretty much Spurs weren't going to score. So I don't wholly buy formation only. And I've lived through recent times and longer ago when playing those players in that formation away to your rivals in the Champions League quarterfinal literally would have been called, you know, kamikaze with attacking intent. So I still think that, number one, defend better at home. The way in which Son's first two goals, well, the first two goals for Spurs were conceded last night was atrocious. And they lie, if you want my honest opinion, they lie at the heart of what I'm still not convinced by City about. That when you can eradicate mistakes when you're being attacked, how to win the ball, where to win the ball, how regularly to do that cleanly and without any glimpse of a chance to the opponents, that's their one pending assignment under Pep.
So, Graham, he has had a couple of attempts now. Can you tell me, you know, how many more attempts is he going to have with Manchester City to try and win this trophy that they so badly want? You know, because, I think in retrospect, when we look back in many years to come, I think people will look at Pep Guardiola's career and they'll say, look, he didn't win the Champions League with Bayern Munich if he hasn't done it with Manchester City, but he's still winning league titles. And to me, they are the toughest trophies to win. Champions League is a knockout competition. It can go anyway. But who dictates as to whether or how many more chances he has with Manchester City to win this trophy that they crave so much? Is it the owners from Abu Dhabi or is it Pep himself? How many times will he keep going at it?
Organisationally, there is a satisfaction with him. There is a degree of, how best to say this, not all for one, one for all, from the owners through the first management layer to Pep, but it's a concordat in that it's not wholly hierarchical. There is definitely a jigsaw puzzle of intention and understanding and belief that will not be broken by this elimination. So there will not be a pressure on him, the sound of a clock ticking now because of last night from the owners or from the management layer, which is Ferran Soriano and Chicky Biggers, Stein and Puffin. There won't. But I heard your question. Partly you were asking, I can tell you, and I'm not talking about inside sources, but I know from certain information that I'm given from people around him, he's very, very, very tired right now, exhausted. There has been a toll on him for the consistent pressure, but from the high pressure level he's working at, but I am talking above anything else, the pressure he puts himself under. And yeah, there might come a time ahead of when he's set his wish to move on, which is about 3 years' time, there might come a time when the cost is too high. Right now, I don't think it's that. Right now, if you're asking, does he stay? Are we going to see a shock like Zidane or Cantona leaving Real Madrid or leaving United when Pep says, sorry, everybody, I've just had enough? I don't think that's coming now, no. But I think your question is shrewd and I understand it. And were this pattern to repeat or were the title to slip away, then small thoughts in his head about how much this is costing him personally might rise. But I really would be surprised if we're back on in June and you're saying, see, I hinted to you that he might walk away. Then I'll admit that I was wrong now, but I'd be very surprised. Very surprised indeed.
Graham, thanks very much for joining us this morning. I hope you get to where you're going to pretty quick, but we'll hopefully chat to you again soon on Off the Ball AM. Thank you.
I am where I should be.
Graham Hunter there, Spanish football journalist. We're going to crash into rugby next here on OTB AM. First of all, though, before we speak to Gordon Darcy, here is Keith Wood on whether Munster can pull off another miracle match this weekend.
Their histories didn't fully overlap, you know, when things were going very well for them. And is this the time when it might? I don't know, but sure, why wouldn't? Like, that's what I'm going to go for. I'm going to say that Munster are going to have one of those crazy, crazy days that they so often have. And after a period of time when they do happen, you have to stop saying that these are kind of miracle matches because they happen a bit too often. So for Munster, they need to have a couple of them, right? Because Leinster would still be favourites if that were to happen. But I think why not? I do think Leinster will hit top form at the weekend because I think they have the time to. I think there's enough of bitterness in Munster from that loss a couple of years ago. I think the players are a bit older, a bit more mature, a bit more savvy, have done a lot since then. And I think they will be looking at this as an opportunity. And that's what I would ask for. If both teams take it as an opportunity and meet the pitch of the game very early, I think they both have a chance to go through.
Keith Wood there speaking about Munster. So I'm delighted to say we've been joined on the line by former Ireland and Leinster centre Gordon D'Arcy around the launch of the new and approved Aviva Stadium Tour. The Aviva Stadium Tour provides fans with a unique behind-the-scenes experience of Ireland's primary international sports stadium, giving them a first-hand experience of what match day is like for our international football and rugby players. Gordon D'Arcy, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Great to see you. You got a chance to do the tour earlier this week. What was it like?
Yeah, it's good. A little bit nostalgic having a walk around the stadium. Kind of a little bit more comfortable on the inside of it rather than sitting up in the stands, or maybe even more comfortable on the pitch. But it was nice. It was kind of some nice memories getting back into the change room and then actually seeing one of the 09 Grand Slam winning medals and a ball signed by most of the 1948 team who won a Grand Slam as well. So it's nice kind of seeing that thing and knowing you were part of that that history and that legacy.
It's brilliant. The inside of it really has developed. I have to say, I remember going in and doing a tour myself when the stadium first opened, and there was a little dentist's room in there. You never had to go in and get any dental treatment, did you, during a match?
Yeah, that wasn't just for dental treatments, to be fair. That was for when anything happened. So you break your arm, do anything, you're in there in the dentist chair.
Good stuff. Well, look, I'm sure I'm definitely going to pop down and see it myself. It looks like some great memorabilia and that kind of thing there. Of course, Gordon, we're going to look ahead to the Champions Cup semi-finals, the Heineken Champions Cup semi-finals this weekend. We'll come to Leinster in a moment. Of course, Saracens taking on Munster at home. That's live on Off the Ball this weekend. The big thing I've been seeing in the media this week, Gordon, is Owen Farrell. How to stop him and his tackle technique are the two things that keep coming up. Maybe on the first one first. You know, he's in the form of his life at the moment. Not an easy man to stop.
Yeah, I think a lot of emphasis will come in on the back row from Munster and how much pressure they can get onto how they can get onto the halfbacks for Saracens. The Saracens are in that kind of enviable situation. They have the home game, and they can look to try and apply pressure to Munster. And there's a lot of similarities being talked about the English game. That if Saracens can only give Munster possession deep in their 22, it can be very, very hard to build pressure at that. So that would mean Saracens are kicking and playing on their terms. Peter Romani, CJ Stander, guys like this have to try and disrupt that fluidity that Saracens tend to typically have. So they need to get Owen Farrell kicking maybe a step early or standing a couple of yards deeper, which will feed into what Munster are trying to do, because they're a very dangerous back three and they are dangerous on their across, but they just need to get possession in attacking positions in the field. So and then, like, we know Owen Farrell can be rocked, so I'm sure the hard end of Peter Romani's shoulder, if that was if that fell in just a step too late, and just remind him that he's there, it wouldn't be too bad.
Is his tackle technique something, I've read that this is being addressed with the referee, is it something you think it's right the Munster side of this game need to be highlighting?
Yeah, like, without debating the merits of his tackle technique, it is quite, it has been raised by referees and the third or the and the fourth official numerous times. So he is playing on the edge. He is definitely on the cusp of it. And some of the decisions have gone his way, and some of them haven't gone his way. There's no doubt he's a physical player. The pleasure of I wouldn't say the pleasure, but getting hit by him a couple of times, and he definitely packs a serious punch. So I'm not sure why he goes for this, that extra 10 or 15% into the tackles when he's already a phenomenal defender. I suppose that probably gives you an insight into the psyche of the guy. But yeah, it's definitely something that you want to. Like, this is a tried and tested route for captains. You know, you've seen Paul O'Connell, Martin Johnson doing it. You've seen coaches talking about it, Declan Kidney, Clive Woodward, guys at that, where they just preempt something that there's a good chance of it happening. So it's almost putting the pressure onto the referee that if Owen goes for that big shot and it's anyway high, that, they are trying to get the referee on the side of a yellow card or a red card before it's even happened.
Sadly, Joey Carberry not available for Munster. So can Tyler Blaindell do, can, you know, what can he provide for Munster that might help them get over the line this weekend?
Yeah, I think the noises coming out of Munster have been really good this week. And Svan Gran, you know, huge positive pressure being put on Blaindell, saying, you know, this is why we kept him for days like this. You know, we have the utmost confidence in him, and that's absolutely the way it should be. I think trying to flip this from a negative, perceived negative, into a positive is the opportunity here for Conor Murray to stamp his mark on the game is really there. I suppose this has been crescendoing up since the Six Nations, which obviously hasn't gone well for a lot of players. So this is an opportunity for Conor to come back, and you know, he's been very vocal about the people who have doubted him and saying, "Oh, well, I'm injured," the injuries and all the narratives and the conversations that have been happening outside of it. This is a huge opportunity for Conor to control this game, and he gets that opportunity with Frank Grant. He seems to have a huge amount of faith in him, and lets him, you know, try and spark a bit of creativity. So I think the 10 conversation will be dependent on how well Conor fires at the weekend. And I kind of think, just, you know, reading stuff, and this is, you know, we don't have any insight into what's happening in the camps, but two guys I think particularly that are going to fire, I think, are due big games and are shaping up for them, are Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton.
Johnny Sexton, your old teammate, hasn't played in 5 weeks, Gordon. He actually hasn't played for Leinster in 2019. Can he just turn it on this weekend?
Like, absolutely. He's in that really, really interesting place where he understands his body completely, but he understands rugby. And he's not one of those players now that needs, you know, two games to get his touch back in or to find his kicks or anything like that. He's one of those guys who can just turn it on every time he steps on the pitch. So I expect this time to be no different. And, you know, when you look at the guys that he's learned from down through the years, like Ronan O'Gara, the bigger the challenge, the bigger, you know, the taller he stood up. And I think Johnny is one of those guys as well. The bigger the challenge, he likes to come back from and likes to, like, leave his mark on the game. And he is World Player of the Year. So I think we really have to put a little bit of faith in this guy that once the pack in front of him get any sort of momentum into it, that he'll make the right decisions at the right time. And Leinster are in a lot of position, in the same position as in Cyrus, as they are, about trying to apply that pressure game into the game, and just take their opportunities when it comes. And no better guy than Johnny to do it.
Before I ask you, will we have a red and blue final? I just want to. You know, Gibson Park, obviously, James Lowe, Scott Fardy, there has to be a decision made. There can be only two of those guys in the team. I'd imagine Scott Fardy's going to start. So is it between Gibson Park and Lowe, and who would you play?
Like, this is why I'd just never be a coach. you know, you can put a week's thought processes and really good analysis and everything into why you picked Lowe or Gibson Park. And then a break of a ball, a refereeing decision, makes the other one look like the better decision. So I think the selections has looked like they go with Gibson Park, because I suppose the importance of a number nine in the context of an 80-minute game, as opposed to a winger who could be shut out of a game depending on the kicking strategy that Saracens go, would probably mean I think they would err on the side of going with Gibson Park on the bench.
Okay.
I wouldn't have an opinion on it, because
yeah,
probably be wrong.
Okay, well, listen, Gord, before I let you go, it's the final we've wanted for so long, Munster versus Leinster. We've come so close so many times. Is it possible this year we could get it?
Yeah, of course it is possible. This is it's a huge game for Leinster against a resurgent Toulouse. But these are, like, you win a Heineken Cup, you do not get an easy game once you come out of the group stages. So Leinster have to perform if they want to challenge, they want to be part of this legacy. They've got to put pressure on themselves, and they've got to get there. Same with Munster, you're going to have to win on the road. They need to tap into the the Munster tradition and the legacy that, you know, listen to Keith's soundbites earlier on, that the Keith Woods and the Paul O'Connells and the Anthony Foley's, that they knew how to win, and it's about winning. by hook or by crook. And I think if Munster can just get under the skins of Saracens and play on that external scrutiny that's on their club, on Saracens at the moment, they might have a chance. And the great thing about semi-final rugby is pressure does funny things to teams. There'll be no rhyme or reason for it. There'll just be a nice hindsight bias at the end of the final whistle.
Leinster and Ireland legend Gordon D'Arcy, thanks a million for joining us, and thanks for promoting those Aviva Stadium tours, which I'm sure we'll all get down and have a look at. Take care, Gordon. Enjoy the games at the weekend. Next up on OTB AM, we're going to have Ryan Burnett. But before that, I want to show you a preview of a chat between Andy here to my left and Cathal O'Grady, who's a former Olympian, boxer, cancer survivor, and the godfather of Irish white-collar boxing. You can watch it on our YouTube channel after we wrap today, and it'll also be aired on OTB AM tomorrow morning.
And do you remember your first fight?
I remember. I had a load of fights. You know, I suppose I started boxing when I was 7 years of age, 6 years of age. So, you know, I had all these fights. They were unofficial fights. You know, you weren't meant to win or lose, but, you know, You usually did win all the time anyway. But I remember when I was 10 years of age going to Wexford for a fight, and we got down to Wexford. Our club was Southmead. It was a great club. Seamus McDonough actually was from there, and you know it was a great club. We went down a little minibus to Wexford, and when we got down there, there was no fight. I had no fight, and I was absolutely devastated. But there was this kid who was 12 years old, and he, you know, 10 and 12, there's a big age difference, and he was also 5 kilos heavier than me. And I said, look, I want to fight him. And the guy said, no, you know, this guy is after winning the Wexfords, he's after winning the Leinsters, he's going into the Boy 2 All-Irelands, you know, and he's a hopeful, he got Leinster Boxer of the Year. I says, I still want to fight him, you know. He was there, I remember it to this day. I was there with me jeans, and I had this green detail, the pockets stitched in, no back pockets, and he had a pair of jeans with back pockets and all. He had one of these varsity tops. It was black with some, you know, some letter. We'll say it's W for Wexford, and the white sleeves. And he had a girlfriend at 12, this blonde girlfriend with curly hair. Oh. She looked like she was just out of a board Bia ad advertising milk or something like that. So anyway, they agreed.
You hated him straight away.
You know, like, if the girlfriend wasn't one reason enough, the jacket and the jeans was two more reasons. So they agreed to fight, and his coach said, we're going to stop this as soon as it gets out of hand at all, because this is, you know, this is ludicrous. And I was here just nodding my head, you know, thinking, yeah, well, they'll stop it all right. So anyway, the bell rang for the first round, and, you know, I unleashed hell on this poor guy. And I know they rang the bell early after, you know, in the first round, because I was hitting them with absolutely everything. I think it went around 20 or 30 seconds into the second round, and that was enough. I think that was that poor guy's boxing career over. I remember going back to my corner and kind of expecting the girl to be there with the jacket in her hand waiting for me, but, you know, she wasn't, you know. Yeah. I had to wait a couple of more years to get my first girlfriend, and
well, that's the thing. Like, sometimes with boxing and with sport, you think that victory or winning or being successful kind of will complete the circle, or will kind of, like you said, you think you thought the girl or that everything was going to be great, but it doesn't.
Andy, you speaking there to Cathal O'Grady, as I mentioned, the video is going to be up on our YouTube channel, which people can check out after the show today. How did he get on your radar? What was the thought behind going down to chat to Cathal?
I've known Cathal for years. He was involved in the Irish setup back in 2003 at the start of the high performance, and we've always been good friends and stayed in touch. And he actually was very open and honest in the conversation that we had there, and I found out a lot more about him then than I didn't know, you know, from being his friend. So it's a very good interview, and it's quite inspiring. And if, you know, I'd urge people to go out and check it out. And if you don't get anything, you'll get a good laugh out of it, because he's such a character, you know.
As I mentioned, he's a cancer survivor as well. Whereabouts, or what kind
of cancer?
He had cancer
in the roof of his mouth.
Right.
And he had some of that removed, and it's he's all over it now. But it was not that long ago. So, yeah. But he stayed, like, he just took it on like a fight, you know, and challenged it and was very open about it as well. Yeah, great character, great guy, and a hell of a fighter in his day. European champion back when, like, the European champions were a very hard title to win, medal to get. So, and a hell of a puncher. So, training with Freddie Roach, training with Eddie Futch, and yeah, spent a lot of time in America and
big bang.
Heavy puncher. Even when he was retired, he came. He'd come in and do a bit of sparring. He'd be dropping lads of body shots left, right, and centre. yeah, what a guy.
Okay, well, listen, you can check that out on our YouTube channel. Andy Lee there chatting to Carl O'Grady. Looks really interesting. We move on from one friend to another, Andy, and the former WBA and IBF bantamweight champion Ryan Burnett is joining us on the line. Good morning, Ryan.
All right, mate. Hi, Spengs.
All good, thanks, Ryan. How are you keeping?
Yeah, I'm good day after day, so feeling good.
You're going to be getting into the ring very soon again?
Yeah, May 17th, next month, not that far away.
Ryan, how's everything? How's your body holding up? You know, you're coming back from a kind of a freak injury.
Yeah, everything's good. I've been back training now for a couple of months and I've had no pain whatsoever, so everything's moving correctly.
And have you been were you getting rehab on it, or have you been checking in with the doctors, or are you just taking it on a pain basis?
No, I was doing a lot of physio when I was in Belfast. When the injury had happened, I started my physio.
Just explain to people what the injury was again.
So I ripped my internal oblique and the muscle came off my hip bone as well during the fight.
Throwing a right hand, a routine right hand, a fight which we were winning and dominating.
Yeah, and we went to had the scans and everything the day after, and the doctor had said it's just a complete freak injury.
So preparing for your comeback, with that in the back of your mind, how do you handle that? What is there any fear that might repeat?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. I had the same questions in my own head about the time when I split my head open. Would it open up again? And it just didn't bother me. It's the same with my side. Like, I've sort of forgotten about it now because there's no pain, there's no reminder. So it feels as if my body feels as if it hasn't happened.
And you're preparing for this fight, Gilbert Gamora, an opponent from the Philippines. What do you know about him? What are you expecting from him?
He's southpaw. He's game. He comes to win. He's a featherweight coming down the super bantam. I'm moving up the super bantam because the opportunity is there. And that's about it. Adam knows his stuff. Adam's told me exactly what I need to do. So just been listening to Adam and taking it from there.
You've never been really one to look into your opponents too much. And is that always been your approach?
Yeah, I mean, Adam just showed me a 30-second clip and I nodded my head and went, yeah, he'll do.
It could be anybody, I suppose. Yeah. At this stage in your career, you're moving up in weight. What are the reasons, or what is the motivation in doing that? Were you struggling at bantam, or is this just for opportunities at the higher weight?
There's just an opportunity that's come up at super bantam. I mean, I can still make bantam weight quite comfortable. I'm a natural bantamweight, but I know I can hold my own at super bantam. So the opportunity came at the weight above, and if Adam's decided it's the correct way to go, then I have to listen to him. He's a man that knows what's going on.
Mm. Ryan, it's obviously your first fight since that defeat to Nonito Donaire. Are you the kind of fighter, though, when you have a defeat like that, was there much analysis of that fight done to see maybe where it went wrong, or do you like to just put it behind you and move on?
It wasn't really, I couldn't really look back on the fight and class it as a defeat. It was an injury, it was a freak injury, and I thought myself that I was winning the fight, I was starting to settle into it, so I haven't really dwelled on it too much. I mean, it's in the past, we knew what way the fight was going and how I was settling into things. And it wasn't his boxing ability that had beaten me. It was an injury. Mm.
You obviously have won the straps in the past. Does that give you the hunger? Does it kind of motivate you more to know that, look, I've done this before, I've got to the top of the mountain, I can get there again?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm only young as well. I'm only 26. So I've got plenty of time in me. And now I've got a the experience behind me. So I know the process. Mm. Yeah.
Ryan, find a home headline at the Ulster Hall. What are you expecting there? You know, this is a famous venue in boxing.
Sorry, I cut off. Say it again, Andy.
Sorry, headlining in the Ulster Hall. Are you looking forward to that?
Can't wait. The Ulster Hall always has an amazing atmosphere. So now I get to headline my own show there, and it's sold out really quick. I mean, within a couple of days, there was very little tickets left. So it's going to be a sellout venue.
It's unbelievable atmosphere in that in Nils Hall when it's full like that and there's a good fight. Yeah. The knowledgeable Belfast fans, it's a great place to be. I'll be up anyway supporting you.
Yeah, I'd imagine as well, Andy, because we are sort of starved of boxing down here. We're not getting many big fights. And I'd imagine there should be a lot of boxing supporters. It looks like Ryan's got a bit of company there this morning.
Hey! How are you, Adam?
I'm good. You all right?
Good, yeah, good, very good. I'm getting low down.
Have you forgotten that Thursday is the rest day?
No, well, that's why I kind of would ask him. But I knew Ryan's up early. He doesn't like a lie-in, you know.
But I was just saying as well, Andy, I think that there should be a lot of boxing fans from down here as well, probably travelling up as well.
Packed. Ryan is one of the few world-class fighters we have in Ireland. It's going to be a big event, so everyone will be coming to see him, and if not, tuning in to watch him, you know.
How do you find that atmosphere in the Ulster Hall? As Andy said, Ryan, it is really unique. It's an incredible venue, and when the place is rocking, it really does rock. When you're coming into the ring, do you try and shut all that out, or do you feed off it?
No, I lap it up. I mean, I had two big shows in the Odyssey, and the atmosphere was incredible. And I sort of, in those moments, I soak it all in, and I enjoy it, so I expect the same thing in the Ulster Hall, if not a bit more, because the venue's slightly smaller and the atmosphere is going to be a bit more pumped, so can't wait to experience that.
Ryan, this maybe Adam can answer this. Have this fight in May 17th, all going well. What's the plan for Ryan going forward?
Be active and get a bit of momentum going. So after this fight, If there's nothing available that's significant in the sort of near foreseeable future, the plan will be to get him back in the ring as soon as possible, just to get that momentum and that competitive edge back in again.
Well, Ryan being a huge name is always likely to get a big fight, especially in the new division. What champions would you fancy?
Well, any of them really. Mm. I mean, it's funny that the super bantamweight is. The fight being a super bantamweight is just to open up other opportunities, because the difference between bantam and super bantam isn't much, right? It's 3 pounds. And I believe actually that the harder fights, the more accomplished, more capable champions are actually in the bantamweight division, not the super bantam. And ultimately, Ryan's a bantamweight. So the fight at super bantam is to open up extra options, but ideally, if a bantamweight world title fight came up, that's the one that we'd go after. Everything's tied up at the moment, certainly for the next few months. So rather than sitting on our thumbs waiting for something to become free, it's just about getting Ryan back in and getting some momentum going.
Ryan, Adam, thanks a million for joining us.
Can I just ask Adam a question before you go? Ryan, thank you very much for joining us. I'll just enjoy your day off. But Adam, Joe Joyce just joined the gym. Is he going to be fighting Joshua in June?
Oh, you've smoothly breezed into your journalistic capacity now.
What's that? No comment.
What did you ask?
Is that a no comment?
No. I genuinely was too busy thinking about what I wanted to say to you. So what was the question about Joe?
Is he going to fight Joshua in June?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything. I saw Eddie sort of trying to talk it down, saying that he doesn't consider him a contender yet. So I don't know. What I do know is that he's probably an unnecessary risk for AJ at the moment.
Okay.
Well, Adam, Ryan, thanks a million for joining us this morning, and best luck with the preparations ahead of that big fight. Ryan Burnett against Gilbert Gomera on May 17th in Belfast. And I'm sure we'll be talking to the lads a little bit more before that fight comes up. So thanks to them for joining us this morning. Now, folks, we've got an OTB exclusive for you right now, and this is going to be something of great interest
to Liverpool fans. We've got a first look at the new Liverpool jersey for 2019-2020. It's available to pre-order right now, and we've got a first look at it. It's dedicated to the legendary Liverpool manager, Bob Paisley. There you have the new Liverpool shirt. I have to say, I do like it. I like it a lot. I'm not a Liverpool fan, but I'm a big fan of those thin white stripes. They look fantastic. And I'm sure the players are going to look resplendent in those shirts now next season. So there you go. The new Liverpool home and away shirts, 2019-2020. Andy, you're a man who likes your style. I know you don't like Liverpool, but you like those shirts?
They're nice. With any shirt, though, the sponsors kind of ruin it, don't they? They kind of take a look away. I know they have to have them on there, but yeah, it's pretty nice. Yeah, it's not too dissimilar. I don't know the difference in the current Liverpool jersey, but...
I think you get to a certain age as well where you just can't be wearing football shirts out in public, can't you?
Yeah, your body gets to a certain shape where it doesn't look good anymore.
Well, Andy, yours looks better than mine, I have to say that much.
Not too much these days.
Well, we're going to give away one of those shirts as well, so jump over to offtheball.com and you'll find out there how to win one of those new Liverpool home shirts. And of course, every day next week as well, we're going to give away one of those shirts. So get on to offtheball.com for your chance to win one of those. So I think we're going to have our little music chat now. We did speak about this yesterday, and I was talking to the lads about... I know I wanted to talk to you about music a few times before this, Andy. Or actually, before we get on to that, though, we're going to chat to you. We're going to see Johnny Sexton being talked about by our rugby correspondent, Rory O'Connor.
He's trained fully so far this week, as far as we're aware, although last time we thought he was in the mix, and it was on the eve of the game that it kind of came to light that he was going to miss out. So you hope, like, just for Sexton's sake, I mean, the last reference point we have for him is that game in Cardiff where he was at war with himself and things just started going terribly, terribly wrong. And you just want a new reference point. You want to see him back to where he was a week before that against France, because he was very good that day. You want to see him running things. You want to see him just back to being Johnny Sexton in 2018 rather than the one we've seen in 2019. You hope that this bit of win, you know, Leinster said it was very precautionary to leave him out of that Ulster game, which was a risk. You'd hope that they've given him the time and space to get everything right, whatever the problem is. It's a quad strain, is what they're saying. Whether he's been out in Santry to kind of work on that area again, because that's kind of been the root of all of his issues the last couple of years. Yeah. You just hope that he's got all those things back and he's moving well and that he's able to run the show. Because if he's still fighting with his body and fighting with himself and, you know, arguing with referees, he's not leading the team in the way that they need to be led. And as captain, which was an extra bit of responsibility he got this season, they looked to him even more than they ever did before. Nisse was gone as a touchstone for, you know, Nisse was the one who set the tone for them so often in these big games and these big weeks. You know, they look to Sexton now, and if it's not 100% with Johnny, you just fear that, you know, there's other factors going on, that he's starting to, you know, bollock people who possibly don't deserve it, or he's, you know, raging at the ref, or things are just starting to go wrong. So we've no evidence that it's gotten better, but except for the body of work that he's put in before this year and the old classes permanent line that people trot out about him. But he is 33 now, I think. He's on the back of an injury and a bit of rough form.
Yeah.
And for Leinster's sake and Ireland's sake, they need him back fit and firing, because there are too many... Leinster have not hit the heights of last season, and that, to me, is a concern, because Toulouse, while they're loose in the extreme, are able to do wondrous things, as they proved when they beat Clermont 47-44 at the weekend.
Rory O'Connor there speaking about Johnny Sexton and Leinster ahead of that big Heineken Champions Cup semi-final this weekend. Now, all this morning on OTBAM, we're giving you the chance to win an amazing trip to Japan for the Rugby World Cup this autumn. We're asking you three questions across the morning, and they're all related to the same game. Ireland's Rugby World Cup quarter-final defeat to Argentina in 2015. To be in with a chance of winning, you've got to answer all three questions in the same tweet or comment. We tweeted question one at 7:45. Question two, 8:15, and now we've got the third question, which is, who was Ireland's out-half against Argentina in the 2015 Rugby World Cup quarter-final? Who was Ireland's out-half against Argentina in the 2015 Rugby World Cup quarter-final? If you've got all three answers, send them to us right now. We'll be sound And we remind you of all three of our questions right now, though. Question one was, how many points did Ireland lose to Argentina by in that Rugby World Cup quarter-final in 2015? Question two, who scored Ireland's first try in that Rugby World Cup quarter-final defeat to Argentina? And the third one, I've just read there, who was Ireland's out-half against Argentina in the 2015 Rugby World Cup quarter-final? It's an amazing prize, folks. Get in there, send us all three answers now, and we're going to pick a winner for that at 9:30 this morning. So, Andy Lee, I'm going to play you a clip right now, and you can tell us about it afterwards. That sweet, sweet soul music.
Yeah.
Little Stevie.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Now.
That's the dressing room before I fought Khabib in Las Vegas, before I won the world title. And that song became a bit of a, I don't know, I guess like an anthem for me. But it wasn't until, like, I lived in Detroit and never picked up. It wasn't until I went to London and was training with Adam. And one day he put on this song during the gym. And I was like, what's that song, you know? And any time I heard it, it would just like really get me, I don't know what, it was emotional, but it would pump me up and, I don't know, focus me on some reason.
Yeah.
So then that became like a song for me, even like before Big Spaz put that on. And every time before I fought, I'd put that on, didn't even walk out of the dressing room, yeah.
Stevie Wonder, one of my favourite artists, I have to say, amazing singer. He just had everything, drumming, piano playing, the whole lot. I'm just interested though as well, because I'm seeing how emotional you're getting there in that changing room before the fight. And, you know, because we often hear sports people say you want to take the emotion out of it, and you need to go out there and you kind of, I suppose, ice in your veins, you know, that kind of thing. Did you feel the emotion that you felt from the music that helped you before you went into a fight?
Certainly that song. It is about, like, controlling it, you know, and controlling your temperament and your emotion. And in boxing, doing that, it's very important, because the moment you lose your emotion in a fight, you've lost the fight. You know, you kind of have to be in control the whole time. And, like, music is, like, in my career, music was very important. You know, it's like the songs that shape, the songs you train to, the songs you listen to when you're not training as well. And, like, I've had this idea and I've said it to Adrian, and I think we're going to go ahead and do it. I'd like to interview other sports people, and even non-sports people, about the music that they listened to while they were competing or doing whatever they did. Because it is a huge part of anyone's life, I think, you know, and some more so than others.
The first time I met you, we did an interview back in 2007. I was a young buck. You were fighting your first pro fight in Ireland.
Yeah.
It was on the undercard of Bernard Dunn versus Kiko Martinez. And I think what struck me first was, I remember you were wearing a kind of a very sharp suit and a fantastic pair of shoes. And I'm thinking, this fella knows his music, you know. And I think, was that, had you been in Detroit at that stage?
Yeah, I'd been in Detroit. When I went to Detroit.
We got chatting then about Detroit and the whole music scene.
Detroit's a huge, like, in terms of music, the scene there, like, it's the birthplace of techno.
Yeah.
I mean, not that that would have had much influence. It's certainly Motown, being with Emmanuel. The house directly across was where Diana Ross used to live, where we lived.
Wow.
And, like, one of the first boxing events I went to when I was there was in the winter, the February of 2006. We just moved there recently to Detroit, and it was Super Bowl. And Emmanuel had a fight there, and it was full of celebrities, and Aretha Franklin was sitting in the seat beside me.
I
would have met her a few times with Emmanuel and stuff, so that was...
What was she like?
Lovely, just lovely.
Yeah.
Just what you'd imagine, soulful and, you know, very, very nice and, yeah. Martha Reeves would come to all the boxing events.
Oh, I saw Martha live. She's amazing.
Yeah, she was a character here. We used to have a lot of fun at the fights. And also, like, Manuel trained Eminem at one stage, so there's also that hip-hop, like, element to Detroit. And also the Rock, which, you know, it's a big rock place outside, like, downtown, but like around Metro Detroit, you know, like with Iggy Pop and all people like that.
I see, he was actually one of the first artists I mentioned to you, and we found a mutual respect for Iggy and the Stooges.
Yeah.
And because and it's funny actually, because talking about Stevie Wonder, I remember listening to Iggy Pop's got a great show on BBC Six every Friday night. It's amazing, and for a man, he's about 71 now, and he's still breaking new music. But I remember him talking about the first time he went to see Stevie Wonder. I think it was in the Fox Theatre in Detroit, which is a famous music venue back in the day. And he had a great line. He said, "I was driving to through Detroit in a stolen car on a bad errand." Fantastic. But again, one of those kind of, he's just one of those characters where he's just so, he's full of life, and you even see him now, he's got these amazing eyes, and he's such a you know, inspirational character, really, you know.
Yeah, it looks like he hasn't changed in years, doesn't he, you know. I wonder what his diet is, because he keeps the weight down, doesn't he?
He certainly does.
The Fox Theatre was one of the bands that I would have came out, like my ring walk music a lot of times would have been Kings of Leon, and they would have been a band, like, they were probably in their prime when I was in my early years to mid years in Detroit, and I saw them play at the Fox Theatre. It would have been Because of the Times, that album.
Yeah.
But I was into them, like, from Shake Heartbreak, That Times.
Yeah.
Like, so.
Their debut album for me was, I loved
their first two albums were,
yeah, like, Youth and Young Manhood.
Who are these guys? You know what I mean? They're just different. Where are they from? They're from a different era, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the more recent stuff's kind of gone too poppy for me.
Yeah,
but
I'd agree.
They're still legends, yeah.
Your better half as well is a musician as well, is she?
Mod in Cahoots, yeah. They're kind of disbanded now, but they do a lot of theatre, which is music-based theatre. They recently had a show on the Gate, and going to Edinburgh, going to Iceland next week to work with Ragnar Heida, the producer of Bjork.
Yeah,
and then
that's incredible.
Yeah, and then they're going to Edinburgh with a show for the Fringe in August, so they're busy with that.
Yeah. Would you share similar music tastes, or
only on the Detroit, only on the Motown stuff? Yeah, Maud, she loves the, you know, the kind of the divas, the soul divas like Whitney Houston and stuff like that. She's always been for the big singers, you know. And she does like certain elements of rock, but that would be it, yeah. But yeah, music's always been big in the house now. And even my little daughter, she has a little violin. she can play it a little bit. She's on the piano. I have some good videos of it. So, yeah.
I played a lot of music. I was a guitar player myself. Played a bit of brass as well. I was in a marching band many years ago. I always say it's you know, parents should definitely always get their kids into music if they can. You know, well, you know, don't kind of force them into it. But give them the option and see if they take to it.
There were times when she would definitely, like, she's a classical violinist, and there were times where she told me that she definitely wanted to quit, but she kind of, her parents kind of not pushed her, forced her, but kind of encouraged her to keep with it. And now it's a gift that she has, you know. Yeah. Now it's like, she can always earn a living doing it, no matter what way it comes to it. She can always like play in any orchestra, so she's got that. It's a skill and it's a trade that she has, well as a huge, you know, a talent and a great interest. I never had it, but I think my daughter, I would definitely encourage her to do it.
Maud isn't your only connection to music either. A band called The Cribs.
Oh, yeah.
You'd be good pals with.
Yeah, the Gary and Ryan Jowen, they're big boxing fans. I'd followed them for years. It was my younger brother who turned me on to them. Because, like, man's needs, that from those times.
Yeah. Good haircuts, Andy.
Yeah, they're good lads, not similar to yours. I'd followed them for years, and it wasn't until like I became kind of well known as a boxer that they started following me back on Twitter, through Twitter. And we got in touch and blah, blah, and I found out they were coming to Dublin to play a show. So I organised a little training session with Steve Dawson down near Camden Street. And it was a pleasure. And we keep in touch. Those guys follow boxing. You know, they're more in tune with boxing than I am a lot of the times.
Yeah.
They follow all the stories and always ask my opinions. But boxing and music, there's a lot of correlations because of the performance and the rhythm that's involved in boxing. And I guess any sport in a way, you know, that there has to be that kind of, that rhythm. You have to have it naturally, you know, inside you, especially for boxing. you have to set your roof on.
Yeah, definitely. And I know, because it's one of those things I'll always enjoy speaking to sports people about, is music. And Michael Darren McCauley is another one, the Dublin midfielder, who I've bumped into at a few gigs and stuff. He's big into his music. Kevin Kilbane as well. Kevin Kilbane.
Those are two of the guys I'd actually flagged that I'd like to interview for this series when it comes about.
Andy, let's do this together, eh?
We'll get you out.
Let's get this on.
Yeah, you're coming in on it.
Certainly. But look, it's as I said, I just think it's one of those things in life, and I think you need music as therapy, you know. And it's everybody's got their own.
You said Paul Weller earlier, but what?
Yeah, listen, I was very lucky in that I got I grew up in a house where there was a lot of music being played. My mum and dad were big music fans. My dad, like, he was into everything, from Rolling Stones to the Kinks, the Beatles. When he saw the Beatles playing in the Adelphi in 1963. My mum was more kind of Bob Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel, that kind of stuff. So I had that upbringing. And then when I was younger, the whole dance thing took off. The Prodigy was one of my first ones. And then the whole Britpop scene kicked in, and obviously there was a love for Oasis and Blur and all that. I veered away from as I got a bit older, because the quality of music wasn't as good. Big boxing fans as well, Noel and Liam, but definitely got more into the kind of the mod scene and Weller and the Jam and kind of all those old. But I'm into everything. I used to DJ, plays a lot of techno music, that kind of stuff. I've seen some of the great techno DJs over the year, the likes of Carl Craig and Jeff Mills and these kind of fellas. So look, I'm just open to anything. And I go to the concert hall and watch a classical music gig as quick as I would go to see a rock and roll gig, But I know myself and Kev are planning to see Paul Weller in the summer in Trinity College. So we might take you along with us.
I know, yeah. I'll definitely be the odd one out. I'm going to see who's going to dress up more like a Maggie or Kev. Who'll have the longer sideburns?
Get the sharp suit ready anyway. Look, before we get into our news slot with Phil Egan, we've got another video. And this is a former Canadian athlete and current chair of the World Anti-Doping Agency, Becky Scott, joining, speaking to Joe on Off the Ball last night.
It was a very personal experience for me, being directly involved with doping, in that my Olympic medal,
That was at Salt Lake?
Salt Lake City. Yeah. I won a bronze, and then it was upgraded to silver and subsequently gold, but over the next 2 years.
Wasn't sure of the timeline.
Yeah, it was about 2 years. So
when do you get told you're up to silver?
8 months after.
Okay. Letter in the post? Phone call?
I think it was a phone call.
Right.
Yes, yeah.
And is your reaction one of happiness or disgust or a strange mixture?
The silver medal was... I would say I was very, neutral on that. I didn't really want a silver medal.
Doesn't change your life, I guess.
It doesn't change my life, and it isn't really justice all the way. It was either, let's do this all the way or not at all. I think silver would have been a real halfway compromise.
And how long then until gold arrives?
Another 8 months.
8 months. Yeah. Another phone call?
Yeah. Yes.
And are you happier when that one arrives?
Yeah, I was. I was relieved at that point, because I think it was a real unknown. The cases were going before the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Mm. There was resistance and there was appeals, and it actually wasn't going to be a clear-cut case. So there wasn't, I wasn't 100% sure that even though these two women had tested positive, that in fact the Olympic Committee would roll over the results and reallocate the medals. So I was relieved, actually, at the end of the day.
At the time of competing, on the day, around the week, in the build-up to the Salt Lake Games, were you suspicious of those two women?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely.
Why?
Yeah, doping was an open secret in our sport.
Welcome back to Off the Ball AM. Stephen just had to pop out there. I've got Phil Egan with me now with the sports news. How are you, Phil?
All good, trying to still... figure out what happened last night. Like, it was just absolute madness, but it still means obviously we have the possibility of an all Premier League Champions League final, maybe not the one that many would expect, but Tottenham have a semi-final against Ajax to look forward to after last night's drama at the Etihad. And some people might have expected a cagey enough game, 7 goals, 5 of them in the first 21 minutes, VAR involved in giving one goal, ruling one out, but it all means Spurs went through on away goals, 4-4 on aggregate, 4-3 obviously for City. And it's the first time Spurs have reached the last four of the European Cup since 1962. The only blot on the copybook, Heung-Min Son, who scored twice, he was brilliant. He's been performing unbelievably without Harry Kane. He picked up a yellow card. He's going to miss the first leg. Now, the only positive of that is the first leg is at White Hart Lane. So the second leg is going to be in Amsterdam, which you would be imagining would be the tougher of the two games. So they'll have him back for that. Obviously, it means no quadruple for Manchester City. City manager Pep Guardiola says he's still in favour of VAR, although he wasn't sure about Fernando Llorente's goal for Spurs.
It's just to see that maybe the goal from Llorente is handball. For one angle, is handball. For the angle, he saw the referee is not. But I'm fine for the fair football, for the fair decision. So the referee must be helped sometimes. And good, he's offside. What can I say?
Yeah, the two meet at the Etihad on Saturday in the Premier League, and I think there's a feeling that Spurs are in for a bit of a pasting. Obviously, Liverpool fans will be keeping an eye on it. This is the first of two tough games for City, where they play Spurs on Saturday, they play Manchester United next Wednesday in the Derby. And you kind of feel if they win those two, they win the league.
Psychological damage, Phil, from last night for City?
I don't think so, because they won the game. They didn't win the tie.
Yeah,
like, it's fine margins, but I think they'll actually go on now and win their next five games, and it'll probably be fairly anticlimactic. But you never know. Spurs have got a lot of injuries. I suppose if they do slip up, Liverpool are in unbelievable form at the moment. They have a semi-final to look forward to against Barcelona. 4-1 away to Porto last night, 6-1 on aggregate. Mo Salah scored again. He's found his shooting boots again. Sadio Mane, Roberto Firmino didn't even start the game. He came on for the second half for Divock Origi. So the front three all scored. Virgil van Dijk, who could be player of the season, that will be revealed soon enough. He was also on target. So attention turns to the Nou Camp. Liverpool have never lost a European tie at the Nou Camp. Klopp was asked after, how do they stop Lionel Messi?
Thank God I don't have to think about that tonight. And thank God I have a few more nights to think about it, because I think everybody tried it so far and nobody really can do it. We still will try it, but we're looking forward to it.
Does he put a man marker on Messi, do you think, for that game?
No, I don't think so. I just think they probably, like, Liverpool are well ahead in the terms of their development of how to play against a team like Barcelona. United showed glimpses the other night, especially in the first few minutes, where, you know, if you can pressurise someone like Sergio Busquets, you can force them into mistakes. So I think Liverpool will be confident enough they'll have a game plan. They won't man mark. He never tends to do that.
Andy Robertson will be having sleepless nights, though, won't he?
Certainly will. the thoughts of the two flying left backs going up against each other, Jordi Alba and Andy Robertson, is going to make for quite a tie. Obviously, tonight it's about the Europa League, the quarterfinals. Arsenal take a 2-0 lead to Napoli. Chelsea are 1-1 on Slavia Prague. The second leg is at Stamford Bridge. We mentioned Spurs. Former Tottenham midfielder Raphael van der Vaart.
Ah, yes.
We might have to start changing his name to Rafa van der Dart, because he is going to make his tournament debut in a BDO. I know you're a big fan of the BDO, Steve.
I'm a traditionalist, Phil. Yeah. I am a
none of that PDC stuff for you. But he's going to make his tournament debut in the BDO Denmark Open next month. It takes place on the 4th or 5th of May. So obviously, being Dutch, there's a great tradition of Dutch dart players, and with Van Gerwen and Van Barneveld. So Van der Vaart is hoping to follow in those footsteps. I'm not sure he's going to... Like, he could hit the target with a free kick, all right, but I'm not sure he's going to be able to.
I remember him, because I did always watch the BDO, and it obviously was better many years ago, but you would often see some of the Dutch footballers at the lake. Yeah. So I remember seeing Arjen Robben there a couple of times, and Van der Vaart himself. Like, there definitely is there's a big darts following in Holland and amongst the soccer players.
Absolutely, Clare beat Tipperary by 110 to 6 points last night to advance to the Phase 1 final of the Munster Minor Football Championship. And it finished Waterford 1-7, Limerick 10 points, and Dungarvan. Masters champion Tiger Woods is the week off, but there's no rest for the likes of Shane Lowry, Graham McDowell and Seamus Power. They're all in the field for the RBC Heritage in South Carolina, which gets underway later today. And some boxing news. Obviously, I know you were talking about it earlier on, but Jarrell Miller says that he is going to vigorously appeal against the decision to revoke his boxing license in New York, obviously due to fight Anthony Joshua at Madison Square Garden on the 1st of June, but his license was taken away following an adverse finding in a drugs test. He says that he didn't take a banned substance. He denies knowingly taking a banned substance. But Joshua's camp, they say they're considering alternative opponents. I've seen Luis Ortiz as one of the names I've seen floated around.
My money is on Polish New York based fighter Adam Kownacki. He's 19-0. He's beaten some good lads in his last three fights, Gerald Washington, Charles Martin. So he's got a little bit of form. He's New York based. He'll probably sell big Polish fans there. He'll probably sell the remaining tickets. I think there was 20,000 tickets sold already for this fight. So it's too big to cancel. So we'll go ahead. So there's no fear of that Katie's fight being put back or postponed.
Yeah, it won't be a problem for Joshua. I was saying it to the lads yesterday that before the... He was obviously all set to fight Pulev, and then that was gone, and 10 days notice, Takam gets the fight. And actually, Joshua wasn't very impressive against Takam.
No.
But, you know, he didn't have to worry. Ortiz would be a change in opponent, obviously, but a change in style.
Ortiz would be a risk at this stage. Preparing for one style, preparing for one type of fight, and one type of fight, to come in with a guy who, even when he's fully prepared, Joshua, for Ortiz, would still test him because he's such a slick, accomplished boxer.
Mm. And I mean, he had Wilder in all sorts.
Hadn't gotten, yeah, just didn't last.
Andy, you know, you fought in America, you know what the audience is like over there. What do you think the feeling is towards Joshua? Have they been impressed already by what they've seen? Or is he on a mission here? Is it like kind of the Beatles going to America, trying to break America?
He's on the consciousness of the Americans. Even before he was a big name, anyway, he was on like a Under Armour campaign, poster campaign. So his face is recognizable over there.
But does he need to impress them here? Does he?
Oh, he definitely does.
Yeah,
he doesn't need this to be a tentative fight. That was always Klitschko's, Vladimir's problem was that when he had those big chances to cross over and put on big impressive displays, they always went the distance and were quite boring. This is his big opportunity. And Miller would have been a great opponent for him because he would have been aggressive, would have made a fight, and it wouldn't have been all plain sailing, but it would have been an action fight. So that's what they're going to kind of have to. With Ortiz, I don't think it would be that. It would be quite technical. It would be a slow fight. Ortiz would be looking to slow the pace, and
he's 40 now, so
yeah. So I think this Adam Kownacki guy could be, but there are so many, and they're all putting their hands up to want to fight him to get the chance. And get
the other thing, Phil, as well, is that I've seen it also mentioned that there's a possibility that Miller, if he was found to the second test did come in positive, and he was banned, he'd get banned for 6 months, and they might actually wait the 6 months until he completes the ban and then put the fight on.
Yeah, I don't think they can cancel it. I think that too many tickets have been sold.
Yeah, and I think for Joshua and his career, he hasn't fought in a while.
Yeah, he hasn't fought since Povetkin.
And they're putting it back. He was supposed to fight in April 14th. He was supposed to have a date then, but that got shelved when Dillian White, when the fight didn't come around with him. The fight I would like to see is Dillian White. I think he's deserved it. If he's ready, if he's in preparation already, then give him the fight. And that's. But is that a bigger fight in the UK?
Yeah, I think they'd be put off by that. But you're thinking, what is the point of having an all-British fight in New York? Now, I still think it'd be a great fight. The first one was really
exciting.
Yeah. And again, like Dillian White had Anthony Joshua in a little bit of trouble in the second round. But then, in fairness to Joshua, it was the first time he was kind of tested as a pro in terms of his chin, came back and it was an absolutely brutal knockout. You kind of look at some of the people might say, what about the credibility of, you know, bringing somebody else in? But, you know, you look at who there's three big guys in the heavyweight division, obviously. We know Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, you know, they're all going to avoid each other. You would imagine we're building up towards eventually they'll fight. But, like, Tyson Fury's fighting Tom Schwartz, he's not very good.
Well, they wouldn't be recognisable names. No. They wouldn't be very good. There's a real lack of opponents for all
Brazil,
the top three.
Wilder, like AJ, took care of him handy enough.
Yeah, but he's a big, capable guy, and he will come to fight. Similar to Miller in that sense, because he's so big physically. Outside of those top three, Dillian White's the most credible opponent. Mm. So whoever can get him really has then it's a real genuine fight.
Mm.
But that's the problem that these three guys have, that there's no opponents out there for them, and eventually they will have to fight because there'll be
I didn't get to see Dennis Hogan's fight at the weekend. You've watched it. There's an appeal gone through. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, like, watching it, you can see that. I think, you know, we were talking about it on Off the Brawl, saying, like, maybe 7-5 in terms of rounds, but, like,
This, I should mention as well, this is, of course, our Irish fighter based in Brisbane, who was fighting at the weekend.
In Mexico against the Mexican Jaime Munguia. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of felt going over there, you're going to need something unbelievable to win. Now, it was an incredible performance, but it was very tight. Like, there was tight rounds. Mm. So, you know...
He probably won it if it was, like, a play on an even playing field. He won the fight. He won more rounds than he lost. But when you take into consideration in Mexico against a champion on his promotion, all of these things, you kind of have to put it, you know, you kind of have to really nail it, like, you have to dominate, and even then might maybe score a few knockdowns to get the decision under those conditions. But the appeal, it might be arbitrary, but it will help him kind of get a rematch. If not get a rematch, get another title fight with somebody. It'll just kind of, you're kind of going through the motions with the sanctioning body, WBO, and it'll register with them, and they'll have to look into it. I don't think they won't overturn a decision.
It doesn't look good on their judges, does it? No. If they do overturn it,
so they never will, but they might give Dennis like a sweetener where he gets
a rematch.
I don't think he's going to get a rematch, because we were talking about it, like, that Munguia, that could have been his last fight at light middleweight. He'll go up, and there was the worry for Munguia going into the fight, would weight be an issue? But he's talking about going up to the middleweights, you know, which is full of serious opponents from you know, we've got Triple G. See, his opponent has been announced, his next
Steve
opponent.
Rolls,
Steve Rolls, 8th of June, Madison Square Garden. Interesting little story about him. He's unbeaten, Canadian. I was looking at his record. His last win against some lad, Keandre Leatherwood.
What a name.
Recognise the name?
Yeah, my last opponent, yeah.
And like yourself, he got a points win.
Yeah.
Steve Rolls.
Leatherwood can handle himself. He's not a bad fighter. Just doesn't, lacks a bit of self-belief, I think.
That must be so frustrating to watch boxers who have talent and they don't have any belief in themselves.
Yeah, it's all a mental issue, you know. Yeah. But that's what separates the good from the average, I guess.
Have you any issue with Triple G taking that fight? People are saying, like,
I think if it would have been more of a recognisable name, then, like, he needs a comeback fight. It's been off a little while. Mm. If it would have been more of a recognisable, had he fought Munguia, then that could have been more credible. But he needs a comeback fight. But I just think...
But he's looking at that, right?
He can only get this one.
Get a few rounds in, beat this guy, and then I'll take on Canelo, provided he beats Jacobs.
Or Andrade, Canelo, probably, yeah.
Yeah, that's the fight Munguia might get, the Andrade fight. Mm. But looking at him against Dennis Hogan, he's got a lot to learn. He's only 22, but his footwork was poor. And just, Hogan was brilliant. He was so elusive. The amount of times Munguia missed with lead left hooks, and he puts everything into him, loads up in the shots. So I think Hogan, like John O'Carroll in his world title, first ever world title shot, excelled, and he's going to get another crack.
Lads, you put out a great boxing show every week off the Brawl. We've got another one this week, have we?
Yeah, it's available now on all social channels. Went out last night.
Check it off the Brawl. Andy, Phil, and also our two other boxing experts, Ronan Mullen and Simon McGuire, bring out this brilliant show every week. So check it out on all our usual channels, YouTube, Facebook, and of course you can podcast it as well on iTunes and wherever else you get your podcast. So Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
We'll chat to you again. Now, as you may have heard, we have been giving you the chance to go to the Rugby World Cup 2019 in Japan. It's an all expenses trip to Ireland versus Scotland in Yokohama City on September 22nd. It's an amazing prize, and all with thanks to Heineken, worldwide partner to Rugby World Cup 2019 in Japan. We gave away the first of 100 green tickets at our roadshow at the Olympia last month, and we'll be giving the rest away across off the ball all the way up until May 9th, where all 100 green ticket holders will join us at a special event in Dublin, after which one lucky winner will be jetting their way to Japan. This morning we asked you three questions. They were all related to the same game that was Ireland's Rugby World Cup quarter-final defeat to Argentina in 2015. So just a reminder that our winners this morning will each receive one of our much-coveted Heineken green tickets. We tweeted question one at 7:45 this morning. Question two came at 8:15. And then at 9 a.m., you got question three. So question one was, how many points did Ireland lose to Argentina by in that Rugby World Cup quarter final? The answer, it was 23. Question two, and just lost that one there from. Question two, who scored Ireland's first try in that Rugby World Cup quarter final defeat to Argentina? The answer was Luke Fitzgerald. And question three, who was Ireland's out half against Argentina in the 2015 Rugby World Cup quarterfinal? A man who brought us all to tears. The answer was Ian Madigan. So our winners of this morning's Heineken Green tickets are Maeve Broderick and Ronan Gately. So Maeve Broderick and Ronan Gately, well done. Congratulations. You've won one of our 100 green tickets for our roadshow on May 9th. At the end of that night, one lucky off the ball fan will win an off all expenses paid trip to Japan for the Rugby World Cup with thanks to Heineken. That's an incredible prize. So look, thanks Andy for joining us this morning.
It's thanks, been Steven. Great.
And hopefully we'll get that music chat little project off the ground soon. Thanks Phil.
Cheers.
For coming in with all the latest news. And now we're going to take you on to our own Sheehan, who was talking to Chet Galadchuk to close out the show. Chet is the athletic director at Navy and Portico Kane, who has helped to bring Notre Dame, isn't it? I guess the Americans pronounce it Notre Dame, versus Navy game to the Aviva Stadium. The Aer Lingus College Football Series kicks off with Navy versus Notre Dame at the Aviva Stadium next year. Corporate boxes are already sold out for the game, but there is still limited in-stadium hospitality available. The game details can be found on www.collegefootballireland.com. The game is in August 2020, and we're really excited for it. The lads got talking the college football scene, what it means to bring the game to Ireland, and what we can learn from how the Americans do sport.
So the Aer Lingus College Football Series is coming along next year. It's Saturday, August 29th, 2020. It is Notre Dame against Navy. It's the big one. And we've got two people who are central to this event in studio with me at the moment. And I'm delighted to welcome Chet Galadchuk, Athletic Director at the United States Naval Academy, and Padraig O'Kane, who's part of the organising committee for the whole event. Lads, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
It's a sense of welcome back, I presume, Chet. I presume you were here in 2012.
It is. I tell you, we're visiting the same haunts throughout the city, having a great time, really enjoying it, and came over a couple of days ago just to start to work out the detail. You know, I mean, you'd think that a game in 2020 is way down the road and there's plenty of time, but there's so many buttons to push and people to visit and, you know, places to go to, again, re-engage and kind of, you know, get the excitement back and, again, the awareness that Navy Notre Dame's coming back to town. So we're already looking forward to it.
From the powers that be in Dublin, how excited are they for this event?
It's been great. I tell you, everyone has come together. We had the feature of my life last night, met with the Lord Mayor, and so we're taking it from the top down. All the good people are coming out to welcome us, and it's just the city has been so engaging, you know, from the ambassador's office, again, to the city government, to the Bureau of Tourism. Everyone has come out to embrace this contest. I think that we really illustrated the last time we were here what an impact it can make on the city. More than a game. Even a football game is a football game. Rugby's rugby. But this is an event. It's something that really embraces Dublin. It brings together the Americas here, of course, with the Irish people, with a great sense of a tradition, history, a great sense of appreciation for each other, and it's a wonderful event that we've really been proud to be a part of.
Yeah, huge for the economy as well, Padraig. You've been part of this for a couple of years now. As Chet says, a lot more preparation goes into this than just, you know, rocking up next year in 2020 and actually putting the plans in place.
Yeah, like, I mean, 2012, €85 million to the Irish economy from that game alone. And indirectly, that game is still given. We know the network and the business events that happened around it, much more than a game, they're still given connections that were made then. And the same with 14 and 16. So this is the tagline that goes with college football in Ireland, much more than a game, really sees fit. And with Chet and the Navy team over this week, it's not just about the sport in the game. And we know the Aviva very well. And we're with Martin and the team there yesterday, going through the logistics and everything there. But it's what happens around game week as well. It's from, really, we kick in from the Wednesday and we'll go to the Sunday, and the city will completely activate and come together and celebrate.
What have you got planned for that week?
So, in the process, hence where the guys are over, but we will do, there will be parades, there'll be tailgating, there'll be pep rallies. The numbers are huge here in relation to currently 35,000 of Chad's colleagues travelled in 2012. We're probably on track to beat that. We know we're committed to just under 30,000 tickets at this moment in time that are committed and sold outside of Ireland. So sellout, yes, and potentially the 12 game was a record for the largest number of Americans ever to travel outside of the States for a sporting event. Outside of wartime, and it looked like this would beat it again. So we're taking the culture between Dublin and America and bringing that together, and we'll be tailgating and we'll be pep rallying. The midshipmen will be travelling, the Notre Dame band and the Navy band will be travelling. So it's all about pageantry, it's about, you know, the fun around high schools, everything. And obviously there's a serious game on the Saturday that I know Chet intends to reverse the result on this occasion.
Did you have to remind him?
We'll get to that in just a moment, but like August 29th, that suggests to me this is going to be very early in the season, potentially week one.
It is week zero, actually.
Week zero.
Week one is the first weekend for college football at large. But we had a special exception made by our governing body, which is the National Collegiate Athletic Association, which allowed us to move the game a week earlier. And I think it's going to be terrific because of the ability of families to travel and tourism. And it's before that Labor Day weekend, which is a big weekend in preparation for people going back to school in the States. So to have a full week come out, enjoy leading up to the game, and then another week to kind of prepare for the school year, so to speak, to kick in, just places it perfectly. And as Paul mentioned a moment ago, we expect the same type of a crowd. We really do. His corporation, actually, that is managing a lot of the tour packaging and the ticket distribution, has already told us that we're 70% ahead of where we were in the last game at this time leading into the contest. So the energy, the enthusiasm is incredible. And the other thing I thought that was really terrific was the way the Irish community embraced the game. I don't believe there had been an American football game here in quite some time before the last one we played. And whether it was interest or curiosity or what, but I do remember we had about 8,000 tickets that we had saved for the community to distribute when we knew that we had expired every avenue in the Americas to bring over the tourism. And those 8,000 tickets went in 30 minutes on Ticketmaster. I mean, they were gone the moment we put them on. So, again, we hope we have that kind of enthusiasm in the United States, which we expect. Again, we're ahead of where we were. But also, maybe this time around, we can find a way to free up a few more, for, again, the Irish community, so you can really enjoy something very special. And Navy Notre Dame has gone back, the longest standing intersectional, the two different regions of the country, the longest standing rivalry in the history of college football. So we have gone year in and year out with a rivalry that resonates across the land. And to bring that storied game here, and of course, the Irish, being the lead draw here in Dublin, makes it something really special, a lot of fun.
Yeah, the rivalry is fascinating. I mean, you've been athletic director there for quite some time.
Yes.
Things weren't great in terms of the rivalry when he took over. They got to a 43-game winning streak at one point, but then you get to 07, it turns around, and there's been three more since then. So I guess from the point that you took over to now, it's kind of like chalk and cheese, really. It's a much more positive vibe around the rivalry, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Well, typically in sport, a lot of close near misses, almost, 2-foot putts, and you pull it to the left. And we were right there on the edge for many years. But, you're right. You brought it up. You did it at 43. I was kind of hopeful we might avoid it here in another country. But you're right. It went years, where we had a little bit of difficult time. But we savored that moment, of course, when we broke that streak, back a few years ago, and it was something special. And in the meantime, our program has gotten very competitive. We're in a conference, which is a very significant conference now. We were an independent, meaning we scheduled independently and played independently. But now we're, it was some pretty heavy horsepower. We've taken our program to a level that has made us nationally competitive and a program of great national stature and extremely competitive with a storied Notre Dame program.
Yeah, Paul, from your perspective, it must be interesting looking at the phenomenon that is college football over in the United States, that anybody who's been over there, been to any sporting event of any kind in the United States, really knows that they do sport different to how we do, is that it is much more about the event, or not more about the event, just as much about the event as it is about the game. And the game is still extremely important, but that doesn't mean you can't enjoy halftime. It doesn't mean that you can't enjoy the pregame, all that sort of thing. And I think it's something we haven't yet embraced here in Ireland.
We can really learn from it. And the nice thing Chet mentioned about week zero, this is going to be a tentatively a 5 p.m. kickoff, whereas up to now we've been at lunchtime kickoff. So the beauty of that is we'll be doing more things in town, we'll be tailgating, we'll be out and about earlier rather than getting to the stadium so earlier. It also is a huge benefit to Ireland in other ways. This will be the only college football game in, going out that day on ESPN.
That's right.
And we're looking at an audience of somewhere between 4 and 6 million live US audience taken in Ireland. ESPN will come into town, they'll be here from the Wednesday and Thursday. They will look at what's going around, you know, Trinity and down Temple Bar and around town, and they'll follow it. So massive exposure from Ireland just outside of the game itself. In relation to the pageantry and all that, I think we miss a trick here in Ireland. You know, the definition of tailgating over there is having a meal at the in a car park beside a sporting venue. We do it already. We just forget, you know, if you take the band in Croke Park or the Aviva, they don't necessarily just have to be in the stadium, you know. Can they be outside, you know, particularly if you take Clonliff and a place like that, you know, could they be there beforehand? I think there's 40 official marching bands in Ireland. Could they work more? St. Patrick's Day, there's always a queue for American bands coming over here, so on and so forth, who want to be here at times and fundraise and come in. So I think we need to take a step up when you see. I remember for the Penn State UCF in 14, when the GAA were involved, and Pádraig Duffy coming down to Temple Bar when Penn State were doing their pep rally and UCF, and he said, he's kind of going, you know, why don't we do this before All-Ireland on an All-Ireland Saturday, whatever the case may be. But and it doesn't necessarily need to be the big sporting occasions, whether it's an All-Ireland. Mm. We're okay when there's a Heineken European Cup in town, that something happens around the stadium. But I think we could get a lot better and learn from our American cousins. And it's not all about, when you see tailgating going on in the States, it's not all about alcohol. It's about fun, it's about networking, it's about meeting your alumni, someone you haven't seen and it's months, or it's not years in relation to us when we leave college. I think the way the guys embrace alumni, we can't even spell it. They really do stay in touch, they network. And that's probably true sport, Chet, in a big way, that they keep connected on it. So we can learn a lot. The Navy and Notre Dame guys are also going to bring a rugby team. There's going to be a number of other sports coming in, so that will be around the city as well. So that's part of the programme. And the high school games, we're hoping at least 12 high schools from around the States will travel. And that will be probably tight for tickets for the Irish audience at this time. We're going to have hopefully some super high school games, not just being played in Dublin. We're looking to move them out into Meath and Kildare and Louth as well, and to make it a bigger event and that more people are involved. Chet might have touched on as well in relation to tourism. This is not Ireland, England, they're in for one or two nights for a big rugby game. These on average stay seven nights. They're down in Killarney, they're down in Galway, they're up in Belfast, they come in through Shannon, so on. So this is a real Ireland event. The economy, everybody benefits, and people will be feeling this from certainly a week before the game and a week after the game, depending on how people come in and their travel arrangements, etc. So it is a win-win. But on your point, can we be smarter? Could we learn from the culture around halftime, pre-game, post-game from what our cousins in America do? Absolutely, and we should.
Conversation I had yesterday with Martin Murphy, who runs Aviva Stadium. Martin's been a good friend of ours. And I was talking about the neighborhood, and I said, you know, with the tailgating or the pre-game or whatever. He said, well, you know, Chet, he goes, you know, for a rugby match, you know, you got about a three-hour time block. People come in, they have a few drinks, they relax, they enjoy themselves, they watch the event, and they leave. I said, 3 hours? I mean, in American football, it's a three-day event that we lead up to the big game. But real quickly, just to echo a little bit, it is an event. You know, a game like Navy Notre Dame is so much like Army Navy. You know, an Army-Navy is a bucket list game for so many people, something to see that they put on their checklist, you know, before it's all over. I want to see something like that. And it's the pageantry, as it was mentioned, and you know, the national exposure that comes with it, too. And what we're just as pleased about, in addition to the hospitality, the incredible venue, this magnificent city, the wonderful embrace that the Irish community has extended to us, you know, is the fact that it's a game that has worldwide interest. Most teams are of parochial interest, local interest. Mm. Okay, you've got the team here, the team there, the team there. They have the local fans. when you look at Notre Dame, you know, Notre Dame has international interest. You know, the Irish, that's resonated with the history of college football since the inception of college football. You take a look at the Naval Academy. Unlike a lot of other parochial schools that reside in states, and they've got their fans condensed to that state, you know, the United States Navy, you know, is all over the world as well. Mm. You know, we'll have people coming from all over Europe, you know, bases, Army bases, Navy bases, Marine bases, all kinds of military bases, because they adopt, you know, their service academy, you know, to be their team. So, again, it has a worldwide embrace. There will be all kinds of divisions all over the world that will be tuned into this game. But the most important thing is it'll bring great visibility to the country of Ireland. It'll give Ireland a chance to really put its best foot forward on a national stage, on international television.
Well, that's a key point, really, because it's interesting, Patrick, isn't it? After what we've seen over the past 18 months or so, like the Rugby World Cup bid, we were told by World Rugby that Ireland isn't ready for the World yet. We weren't able to put on an event of that scale. Like, next summer, you've got this game, but let's not forget it's coming after a summer where we're going to host three Euro 2020 games. It's probably the summer more than any other summer in Ireland where we will be outwards, facing the world.
And that weekend gets more interesting because, well, the past three games, I think, clashed with All-Ireland Hurling Final. This one clashed with All-Ireland Football Final. Yeah. So what a weekend in Dublin. And we'll just prove it again. Here we will bring in probably close to 40,000 visitors for a game on the Saturday, turn it around and have our 80,000-plus in for the Gaelic Final on Sunday. And it will seemingly go well because most of the supporters in will leave on the Sunday morning, so the bedrooms free up for Gaelic coming in, depending on what teams are, if Dublin aren't involved or whatever the case may be. But what I don't think it's missed on government or on people bidding for big events, how big this can be. As you know, this is the start of a five-game series, and, you know, we'll be annually on this date for hopefully the next 5 years at a minimum. So this is going to be part of the calendar going forward.
Could it be a learning experience as well from an Irish perspective? Because obviously the reason why World Rugby said Ireland isn't ready for the World is because there were some truths in that. I wonder, can we learn from that to actually spread this beyond Dublin in terms of actually being able to create a nationwide event down the line?
I think so. You take college football in Ireland. Chet will meet most of them later on. We have a steering committee, which is a collaboration of public and private sector. So it's your Falls of Ireland, it's your Tourism Ireland, it's your Dublin City Councils. But it's also the private sector, our title sponsors, Aer Lingus, Grand Thornton, Dublin Town and so on, Glendinplex. We've them in, but we've also got the embassy are involved, Department of Education are involved because we've got an academic part of it, Department of Sport, Department of Foreign Affairs because of the connection. So we have a fabulous collaboration. As the event goes on a little bit further, on Garda Síochána join that, Dublin Bus, Dublin Transport come in on that collaboration as well. And we plan this out. And one of the biggest ones, the most simple examples of, and I think we're very good at it, in 2012, the Notre Dame numbers kept driving. I think they originally were looking at 10 to 12,000 travelling, and before you know it they were past 20,000 and heading past 25,000, and they were tailgating down in Temple Bar, and the problem came up in relation to how do we get these people to Aviva, the huge number moving from one area, they don't know our transport system, etc. And I remember us all being very quiet in the meeting going, not sure of the solution, so we banged it on to the next meeting. And to be fair to Dublin Bus, they come in, we're going to solve it, we're putting on a complimentary bus service from the central bank and loop it around into the Viva over and back for all supporters going to the game. That made the Chicago, which is a big paper in Chicago, as a headline story, Dublin's hospitality opened up. So I think we're very good at what we do. We probably don't tell the story as well at times, but we need to collaborate more. And by getting the agencies and the public and private sector together, when we go after a big bid and tell our story properly, we're capable of winning anything.
For sure.
Within reason.
That's the biggest difference, I think, this time around, Owen, is the fact that how the community is prepared and embraced, you know, this game. You know, as Paul mentioned a moment ago, you know, when we came in 12, it was pretty much the uncertainty, you know, of American football and, you know, the agencies that he mentioned, from the tourism, you know, to the police department, just, you know, wasn't sure what to expect. I could not be more confident in the way we've been welcomed, you know, the last 2 days. It's just extraordinary. The job that they've done in setting up the infrastructure in preparation for this game is as good as I've seen anywhere. And again, we run major events in major NFL venues in the United States. So I'm leaving here in a day or two, going back with a great degree of confidence and appreciation, you know, for what the city means, how important it is for us to do our part and deliver an event of the highest magnitude, and know that we'll be well received.
When you do go back to the United States, and I wanted to ask you about this, is your role as athletic director and having been in roles like that for a long time now, like from Boston College to Navy, how different is the world of sport at high performance level in college football at the moment to how it used to be?
Well, I think the biggest difference is amateurism, to be honest with you. Now, here I know that in your professional ranks, everyone's being paid and it's a business. And there was what I would call at one point the purity of college athletics, you know, which pretty much is a, you play for the passion, you play for the love, you play for the enjoyment of the game. And not to say that that has gone away, but if you take a look at the amount of commercialism that's become part of college athletics today, the big business that's involved, the corporate involvement, the television exposure, the amount of dollars that are shared now through the media by virtue of leveraging, you know, a much more attractive product, even more, again, business-like product to the community. It's changed the game in many, many ways.
Should the players be getting a cut?
The players be getting a cut?
Yeah, should they? Like, I mean, like the famous example, obviously.
Well, you know, I think the probably at some point that will happen.
Yeah.
To some degree, you can see at one point it was the justification was the cost of education. You take the United States Naval Academy, 4 years of education at the Naval Academy. I'm not sure in terms of euros, you have to do your mathematics, but $400,000, you know, is the cost of an education. You know, most of those schools now, the tuition at those schools can be $70,000, $80,000 a year. So when you look at that being relieved, you know, for an individual who's asked to compete for that institution, you'd say, hey, that's not a bad, not bad compensation. But the numbers at one point were somewhat comparable. Now, again, the money that is coming in to the schools, the salaries that are being paid to college coaches, the salaries that are being paid to their assistants because, again, of the influx of television dollars has, you know, I wouldn't say it's greed, but there's a dimension of uncertainty and a dimension of being uncomfortable that there's so much money that's being now infused in college athletics. Shouldn't the players get a piece of that?
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of movement in that direction. But to professionalize it would change the whole character of college athletics and make it a quasi, you know, semi-pro environment, which is something we don't want to do.
I guess, like, the big example recently was Zion Williamson in the basketball going down, blowing his knee
out in a pair
of Nike shoes that didn't stand up, and Nike obviously getting good exposure. The college is getting a decent slice of that pie. That nobody's suggesting that they should go full-time athletes because the education is important, but slice of the pie mightn't be the worst.
Scholarship side, though, is huge in relation to what you pay fees in, in the States from that angle. But probably from getting to know Chet and getting to know the colleges we've worked at, the football team or the football department pay for the other 20 or 30 sports that are involved in an academic program, etc., because they don't have the same exposure in relation to or the same level of revenues come in. So football certainly, and basketball probably, and one or two others play towards the allowing 30, 40 different teams play and scholarships towards that as well.
I think we all strive to be self-sustaining, generate enough revenue to make certain you can, as we do at Navy, offer 33 different programs from squash to tennis to swimming to football, basketball and baseball, which we do a pretty good job at that. But again, it's the excessive dollars. You know, when you start paying a college basketball coach $10 million a year, that's not a bad salary.
No.
You know, and the players are looking around going, well, you know, I get, you know, lodging, that's nice. I get a meal, that's terrific. You know, I get my books taken care of. But, you know, what else is there here in terms of some, you know, gravy, as they say?
Yeah.
And especially when they're the show, right?
Yeah.
The athlete's the show, you know. So anyways, we'll see what happens down the road. But there's a big tug of war in college athletics now between, again, the purity, again, as I'm repeating, but of amateurism, and keeping them in the context of education and the semi-professional connotation that seems to be creeping into college athletics at large.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be the tug of war that's constantly going on.
Yep.
Listen, folks, thanks a million for coming in. Chet Gladchuk and Padraig O'Kane. It's part of the Aer Lingus College Football Series, and it is next year. It is Navy against Notre Dame. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Owen. You're
welcome.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.